Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
I want you to remember that no bastard ever won war by dying for his country. He won it by making the other poor dumb bastard die for his country. And then, all this stuff you've heard about America not wanting to fight, wanting to stay out of the war, is a lot of horse dung. Americans traditionally love to fight. All real Americans love the sting of battle. When you were kids, you all admired the champion marble shooter, the fastest runner, big league ball players, the toughest boxers. Americans love a winner and will not tolerate a loser. Americans play to win all the time. I wouldn't give a hoot in hell for a man who lost and laughed. That's why Americans have never lost and will never lose a war. Because the very thought of losing is hateful to Americans. Now, an army is a team. It lives, eats, sleeps, fights as a team. This individuality stuff is a bunch of crap. The bilious bastards who wrote that stuff about individuality for the Saturday Evening Post don't know anything more about real battle than they do about fornicating. Now, we have the finest food and equipment, the best spirit, and the best men in the world. You know, my God, I actually pity those poor bastards we're going up against. By God, I do. We're not just going to shoot the bastards. We're going to cut out their living guts and use them to grease the treads of our tanks. We're going to murder those lousy Hun bastards by the bushel. Now, some of you boys, I know, are wondering whether or not you'll chicken out under fire. Don't worry about it. I can assure you that you will all do your duty. The Nazis are the enemy. Wade into them. Spill their blood. Shoot them in the belly. When you put your hand into a bunch of goo that a moment before was your best friend's face, you know what to do. Now, there's another thing I want you to remember. I don't want to get any messages saying that we are holding our position. We're not holding anything. Let the Hun do that. We are advancing constantly, and we're not interested in holding on to anything except the enemy. We're going to hold on to him by the nose, and we're going to kick him in the ass. We're going to kick the hell out of him all the time, and we're going to go through him like crap through a goose. Now, there's one thing that you men will be able to say when you get back home, and you may thank God for it. 30 years from now, when you're sitting around your fireside with your grandson on your knee, and he asks you, what did you do in the great World War II? You won't have to say, well, I shoveled shit in Louisiana. All right, now you sons of bitches, you know how I feel. Well, I will be proud to lead you wonderful guys into battle anytime, anywhere. That's all.
Context of white supremacy. Justice, Gus T. Renegade, in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, January 9th, 2015. So I have been told. The audio segment that you heard at the beginning of the broadcast, that is the opening, and I mean the very beginning of the legendary film Patton, based on the World War II General George S. Patton. I've heard Mr. Fuller talk about that moment in the film and what that signifies about white supremacy culture, what it means to be a white person. You can watch the whole movie, but just that little snippet right there tells you a lot. And I think you heard in this text, American Sniper Patton was mentioned, referenced last week. So I just thought that was important, that it seems like an important aspect of the Yorugu Asili to reaffirm, worship, revere, and promote white killers from generation to generation. This is the 21st century version. American Sniper, Chris Kyle. This is our third study session. We're picking up at the beginning of chapter 5. Beginning of chapter 5. Context of white supremacy, Chris Kyle, American Sniper, audio segment number 1.
5. Sniper. Taya. The first time Chris came home, he was really disgusted with everything, with America especially. In the car on the way back to our house, we listened to the radio. People weren't talking about the war. Life went on as if nothing was happening in Iraq. People are talking about bullshit, he said. We're fighting for the country and no one gives a shit. He'd been really disappointed when the war began. He was back in Kuwait and had seen something on television that was negative about the troops. He called and said, "You know what? If that's what they think, fuck them. I'm out here ready to give my life, and they're doing bullshit." I had to tell him there were a lot of people who cared, not just for the troops in general, but for him. He had me, he had friends in San Diego and Texas, and family. But the adjustment to being home was hard. He'd wake up punching. He'd always been jumpy, but now, when I got up in the middle of the night, I'd stop and say his name before I got back into bed. I had to wake him up before coming back to bed to ensure I wasn't hit with his basic reflex. One time I woke up to him grabbing my arm with both of his hands. One hand was on the forearm and one just slightly above the elbow. He was sound asleep and appeared to be ready to snap my arm in half. I stayed as still as possible and kept repeating his name, getting louder each time so as not to startle him, but also to stop the impending damage to my arm. Finally, he woke and let go. Slowly, we settled into some new habits and adjusted. Scares. I didn't quit the SEALs. I might have if my contract hadn't still had a lot of time to run. Maybe I would have gone to the Marines, but it wasn't an option. I had some reason for hope. When you come home and the team returns from a deployment, there's a reshuffling at the top and you get new leadership. There was always a chance our new headshed would be better. I talked to Taya and told her how pissed off I was. Of course, she had a different perspective. She was just happy that I was alive and home in one piece. Meanwhile, the brass got huge promotions and congratulations for their part in the war. They got the glory. Bullshit glory. Bullshit glory for a war they didn't fight and the cowardly stance they took. Their cowardice ended lives we could have saved if they would have let us do our jobs. But that's politics for you. A bunch of game players sitting around congratulating each other in safety while real lives are getting screwed up. Every time I returned home from deployment, starting then, I wouldn't leave the house for about a week. I'd just stay there. Generally, we'd get about a month off after unloading and sorting our gear and stuff. That first week, I'd always stay home with Taya and keep to myself. Only after that would I start seeing family and friends. I didn't have flashbacks of battle or anything dramatic like that. I just needed to be alone. I do remember once after the first deployment when I had something like a flashback, though it only lasted a few seconds. I was sitting in the room we used as an office in our house in Alpine, near San Diego. We had a burglar alarm system, and for some reason, Taya set it off accidentally when she came home. It scared the ever-living shit out of me. I just immediately went right back to Kuwait. I dove under the desk. I thought it was a Scud attack. We laugh about it now, but for those few seconds, I was truly scared. More scared than I had ever been in Kuwait when the Scuds actually did fly over. I've had more fun with burglar alarms than I can recount. One day I woke up after Taya had left for work. As soon as I got out of bed, the alarm went off. This one was in voice mode, so it alerted me with a computerized voice. Intruder alert! Intruder in the house! Intruder alert! I grabbed my pistol and went to confront the criminal. No son of a bitch was breaking into my house and living to tell about it. Intruder, living room. I carefully proceeded to the living room and used all of my SEAL skills to clear the living room. Vacant. Smart criminal. I moved down the hall. Intruder, kitchen. The kitchen was also clear. The son of a bitch was running from me. Intruder, hall. Motherfucker. I can't tell you how long it took before I realized I was the intruder. The system was tracking me. Taya had set the alarm to a setting that assumed the house was vacant, turning on the motion detectors. Y'all feel free to laugh. With me, not at me, right? I always seemed more vulnerable at home. After every deployment, something would happen to me, usually during training. I broke a toe, a finger, all sorts of little injuries. Overseas on deployment, in the war, I seemed invincible. You take off your superhero cape every time you come home from deployment, Taya used to joke. After a while, I figured it was true. My parents had been nervous the entire time I was away. They wanted to see me as soon as I got home, and I think my need to keep to myself at first probably hurt them more than they'll say. When we finally did get together, though, it was a pretty happy day. My dad took my deployment especially hard, outwardly showing his anxiousness a lot more than my mother. It's funny. Sometimes the strongest individuals feel the worst when events are out of their control, and they can't really be there for the people they love. I felt it myself. It was a pattern that would repeat itself every time I went overseas. My mom carried on like the stoic one. My otherwise stoic dad became the family worrier. Schooled. I gave up part of my vacation and came back from leave a week early to go to sniper school. I would have given up much more than that for the chance. Marine snipers have justifiably gotten a lot of attention over the years, and their training program is still regarded as one of the world's best. In fact, SEAL snipers used to be trained there. But we've gone ahead and started our own school, adapting a lot of what the Marines do, but adding a number of things to prepare SEAL snipers for our mission. The SEAL school takes a little more than twice as long to complete because of that. Next to Bud's, sniper training was the hardest school I ever went through. They were constantly messing with our heads. We had late nights and early mornings. We were always running or being stressed in some way. That was a key part of the instruction. Since they can't shoot at you, they put as much pressure on you as they can manage in every other way. From what I've heard, only 50% of the SEALs who take the school make it through. I can believe it. The first classes teach SEALs how to use the computers and cameras that are part of our job. SEAL snipers aren't just shooters. In fact, shooting is only a small part of the job. It's an important, vital part, but it's far from everything. A SEAL sniper is trained to observe. It's a foundation skill. He may find himself out ahead of a main force, tasked to discover everything he can about the enemy. Even if he's assigned to get into position to take out a high-value target, the first thing he has to be able to do is observe the area. He needs to be able to use modern navigational skills and tools like GPS, and at the same time present the information he's gathered. So, that's where we start. The next part of the course, and in a lot of ways the hardest, is stalking. That's the part where most guys fall out. Stalking means sneaking into a position without being seen, Easier said than done. It's moving slowly and carefully to the exact right spot for the mission. It's not patience, or at least that's not all it is. It's professional discipline. I'm not a patient person, but I learned that to succeed as a stalker, I needed to take my time. If I know I'm going to kill someone, I'll wait a day, a week, 2 weeks. Make that, I have waited. I will do whatever it takes. And let's just say there are no bathroom breaks either. For one of the exercises, I had to sneak through a hayfield. I took hours arranging the grass and hay in my ghillie suit. The ghillie suit is made of burlap and is a kind of camouflage base for a sniper on a stalking mission. The suit allows you to add hay or grass or whatever so you can blend in with your surroundings. The burlap adds depth, so it doesn't look like a guy with hay sticking out of your butt as you cross a field. You look like a bush. But the suits are hot and sweaty, and they don't make you invisible. When you come to another piece of terrain, you have to stop and rearrange your camouflage. You have to look like whatever it is you're crossing. I remember one time I was making my way slowly across a field when I heard the distinct rattle of a snake nearby. A rattler had taken a particular liking to the piece of real estate I had to cross. Willing it away didn't work. Not wanting to give away my position to the instructor grading me, I crept slowly to the side, altering my course. Some enemies aren't worth fighting. During the stalking portion of our training, you're not graded on your first shot. You're graded on your second. In other words, once you've fired, can you be seen? Hopefully, no, because not only is there a good possibility you'll have to take more shots, but you have to get out of there, too, and it would be nice to do that alive. It's important to remember that perfect circles do not exist in nature, and that means you have to do what you can to camouflage your scope and rifle barrel. I would take tape and put it over my barrel, then spray paint the tape up to camouflage it further. I'd keep some vegetation in front of my scope as well as my barrel. You don't need to see everything, just your target. For me, stalking was the hardest part of the course. I nearly failed because of a lack of patience. It was only after we mastered stalking that we moved on to shooting. Guns. People ask a lot about weapons, what I used as a sniper, what I learned on, what I prefer. In the field, I matched the weapon to the job and the situation. At sniper school, I learned the basics of a range of weapons, so I was prepared not only to use them all, but also to choose the right one for the job. I used 4 basic weapons at sniper school. 2 were magazine-fed semi-automatics, the Mark 12, a 5.56 sniper rifle, and the Mark 11, a 7.62 sniper rifle. When I talk about a gun, I often just mention the caliber, so the Mark 12 is the 5.56. Oh, and there's no point in front of the numbers. It's understood. Then there was my 300 Win Mag. That was magazine-fed, but it was bolt-action. Like the other two, it was suppressed, which means that it has a device on the end of the barrel that suppresses muzzle flash and reduces the sound of the bullet as it leaves the gun, much like a muffler on a car. It's not actually a silencer, though some think of it that way. Without getting too technical, the suppressor works by letting gas out of the barrel as the bullet discharges. Generally speaking, there are 2 types, one that attaches to the barrel of the weapon and another that's integrated with the barrel itself. Among the practical effects of the suppressor on a sniper rifle is that it tends to reduce the amount of kick the shooter experiences. This helps make it more accurate. I also had a 50 caliber, which was not suppressed. Let's talk about each weapon individually. Mark 12. Officially the United States Navy Mark 12 Special Purpose Rifle, this gun has a 16-inch barrel, but is otherwise the same platform as an M4. It fires a 5.56 by 45mm round from a 30-round magazine. It can also be fitted with a 20-round box. Derived from what became known as the .223 cartridge, and therefore smaller and lighter than most earlier military rounds, the 5.56 is not a preferred bullet to shoot someone with. It can take a few shots to put someone down, especially the drugged-up crazies we were dealing with in Iraq, unless you hit them in the head. And contrary to what you're probably thinking, Not all sniper shots, certainly not mine, take the bad guys in the head. Usually, I went for center mass, a nice fat target somewhere in the middle of the body, giving me plenty of room to work with. The gun was super easy to handle, and was virtually interchangeable with the M4, which, though not a sniper weapon, is still a valuable combat tool. As a matter of fact, when I got back to my platoon, I took the lower receiver off my M4 and put it on the upper receiver of my Mark 12. That gave me a collapsible stock and allowed me to go full auto. I see now that some Mark 12s are being equipped with the collapsible stock. On patrol, I like to use a shorter stock. It's quicker to get up to my shoulder and get a bead on somebody. It's also better for working inside and in tight quarters. Another note on my personal configuration, I never used full auto on the rifle. The only time you really want full auto is to keep someone's head down. Spewing bullets doesn't make for an accurate course of fire. But since there might be a circumstance where it would come in handy, I always wanted to have that option in case I needed it. Mark 11. Officially called the Mark 11 Mod 10 Special Purpose Rifle, and also known as the SR-25, this is an extremely versatile weapon. I particularly like the idea of the Mark 11 because I could patrol with it in place of an M4 and still use it as a sniper rifle. It didn't have a collapsible stock, but that was its only drawback. I would tie the suppressor onto my kit, leaving it off during the start of a patrol. If I needed to take a sniper shot, I would put it on, but if I was on the street or moving on foot, I could shoot back right away. It was semi-automatic, so I could get a lot of bullets on a target, and it fired 7.62 by 51 millimeter bullets from a 20-round box. Those had more stopping power than the smaller 5.56 NATO rounds. I could shoot a guy once and put him down. Our rounds were match-grade ammo bought from Black Hills, which makes probably the best sniper ammo around. The Mark 11 had a bad reputation in the field because it would often jam. We wouldn't have jams that much in training, but overseas was a different story. We eventually figured out that something to do with the dust cover on the rifle was causing a double feed. We solved a lot of the problem by leaving the dust cover down. There were other issues with the weapon, however, and personally it was never one of my favorites. 300 Win Mag. The 300 is in another class entirely. As I'm sure many listeners know, 300 Win Mag refers to the bullet the rifle fires, the 300 Winchester Magnum round, 7.62 by 67 millimeters. It's an excellent all-around cartridge whose performance allows for superb accuracy as well as stopping power. Other services fire the round from different or slightly different guns. Arguably, the most famous is the Army's M24 sniper weapon system, which is based on the Remington 700 rifle. Yes, that is the same rifle civilians can purchase for hunting. In our case, we started out with Macmillan stocks, customized the barrels, and used 700 action. These were nice rifles. In my third platoon, the one that went to Ramadi, we got all new 300s. These used Accuracy International stocks with a brand new barrel in action. The AI version had a shorter barrel with a folding stock. They were badass. The 300 is a little heavier gun by design. It shoots like a laser. Anything from 1,000 yards and out, you're just plain nailing it. And on closer targets, you don't have to worry about too much correction for your come-ups. You can dial in your 500-yard dope and still hit a target from 100 to 700 yards without worrying too much about making minute adjustments. I used a 300 Win Mag for most of my kills. 50 caliber. The 50 is huge, extremely heavy, and I just don't like it. I never used one in Iraq. There's a certain amount of hype and even romance for these weapons, which shoot a 12.7 by 99 millimeter round. There are a few different specific rifles and variations in service with the U.S. military and other armies around the world. You probably heard of the Barrett M82 or the M107 developed by Barrett Firearms Manufacturing. They have enormous ranges and in the right application are certainly good weapons. I just didn't like them all that much. The 150 I do like is the Accuracy International model, which has a more compact collapsible stock and a little more accuracy. It wasn't available to us at the time. Everyone says that the 50 is a perfect anti-vehicle gun. But the truth is that if you shoot the 50 through a vehicle's engine block, you're not actually going to stop the vehicle. Not right away. The fluid will leak out and eventually it'll stop moving. But it's not instant by any means. A 338 and even a 300 will do the same thing. Nope, the best way to stop a vehicle is to shoot the driver, and that you can do with a number of weapons. 338. We didn't have 338s in training. We started getting them later on during the war. Again, the name refers to the bullet. There are a number of different manufacturers, including Macmillan and Accuracy International. The bullet shoots farther and flatter than a 50 caliber, weighs less, costs less, and will do just as much damage. They are awesome weapons. I used a 338 on my last deployment. I would have used it more if I'd had it. The only drawback for me was my model's lack of a suppressor. When you're shooting inside a building, the concussion is strong enough that it's a pain, literally. My ears would hurt after a few shots. Since I'm talking about guns, I'll mention that my current favorites are the weapon systems made by GA Precision, a very small company started in 1999 by George Gardner. He and his staff pay close attention to every detail, and his weapons are just awesome. I didn't get a chance to try one until I got out of the service, but now they're what I use. Scopes are an important part of the weapon system. Overseas, I used a 32 power scope. The powers on a scope refer to the magnification of the focal length. Without getting too technical, the higher the power, the better a shooter can see at a distance. But there are trade-offs, depending on the situation and the scope. Scopes should be chosen with a mind toward the situation they'll be used in. To give an obvious example, a 32 power scope would be wildly inappropriate on a shotgun. Additionally, depending on the circumstances, I had an infrared and visible red laser, as well as night vision for the scope. As a SEAL, I used Night Force scopes. They have very clear glass, and they're extremely durable under terrible conditions. They always held their zero for me. On deployments, I used a Leica rangefinder to determine how far I was from a target. Most of the stocks on my guns used adjustable cheek pieces, sometimes called a comb. Technically, the comb is the top piece of the stock, but the terms are sometimes interchanged. The extension let me keep my eye in position when sighting through the scope. On older weapons, we would adapt a piece of hard-packed foam and raise the stock to the right height. As scope rings have gotten larger and more varied in size, the ability to change the stock height has become more important. I use a 2-pound trigger on my rifles. That's a fairly light pull. I want the trigger to surprise me every time. I don't want to jerk the gun as I fire. I want no resistance. Get set, get ready, put my finger, and gently start squeezing, and it goes off. As a hunter, I knew how to shoot, how to make the bullet go from point A to point B. Sniper school taught me the science behind it all. One of the more interesting facts is that the barrel of a rifle cannot touch any part of the stock. They need to be free-floating to increase accuracy. The barrel will float in the stock due to the way the stock is cut out. It attaches only to the main body of the rifle. When you shoot a round, a vibration comes through the barrel, known as barrel whip. Anything touching the barrel will affect that vibration and, in turn, affect the accuracy. Then there are things like the Coriolis effect, which has to do with the rotation of the earth and the effect it has on a rifle bullet. This comes into play only at extremely long distances. You live all of this technical data in sniper school. You learn about how far to lead someone when they're moving, if they're walking, if they're running, depending on the distance. You keep doing it until the understanding is embedded not just in your brain, but in your arms and hands and fingers. In most shooting situations, I adjust for elevation, but not for windage. Simply put, adjusting for elevation means adjusting my aim to compensate for the drop of my bullet over the distance it travels. Windage means compensating for the effect of the wind. The wind is constantly changing, so about the time I adjust for wind, the wind changes. Elevation is a different story, though if you're in a combat situation, a lot of times you don't have the luxury of making a fine adjustment. You have to shoot or be shot. Tested. I was not the best sniper in my class. In fact, I failed the practice test. That meant potentially washing out of the class. Unlike the Marines, in the field, we don't work with spotters. The SEAL philosophy is, basically, if you have a fellow warrior with you, he ought to be shooting, not watching. That said, we did use spotters in training. After I failed the test, the instructor went through everything with me and my spotter trying to figure out where I'd gone wrong. My scope was perfect, my dope was set, there was nothing mechanically wrong with the rifle. Suddenly he looked up at me. "Dip," he said, more a statement than a question. "Oh." I hadn't put any chewing tobacco in my mouth during the test. It was the only thing I'd done differently, and it turned out to be the key. I passed the exam with flying colors, and a wad of tobacco in my cheek. Snipers, as a breed, tend to be superstitious. We're like baseball players with our little rituals and must-dos. Watch a baseball game and you'll see a batter always does the same thing as he steps to the plate. He'll make the sign of the cross, kick the dirt, wave the bat. Snipers are the same way. During my training and afterward, I kept my guns a certain way, wore the same clothes, had everything arranged precisely the same. It's all a matter of controlling everything on my mind. I know the gun is going to do its job. I need to make sure I do mine. There's a lot more to being a SEAL sniper than shooting. As training progressed, I was taught to study the terrain and the surroundings. I learned to see things with the sniper's eye. If I were trying to kill me, where would I set up? That roof. I could take the whole squad from there. Once I identified those spots, I'd spend more time looking at them. I had excellent vision going into the course, but it wasn't so much seeing as learning to perceive, knowing what sort of movement should get your attention, discerning subtle shapes that can tip off a waiting ambush. I had to practice to stay sharp. Observation is hard work. I'd go outside and just train myself to spot things in the distance. I always tried to hone my craft, even on leave. On a ranch in Texas, you see animals, birds, you learn to look in the distance and spot movement, shapes, little inconsistencies in the landscape. For a while, it seemed like everything I did helped train me, even video games. I had a little handheld Mahjong game that a friend of mine had given us as a wedding present. I don't know if it was exactly appropriate as a wedding present. It's a handheld one-person game, but as a training tool, it was invaluable. In Mahjong, you scan different tiles, looking for matches. I would play timed sessions against the computer, working to sharpen my observation skills. I said it before, and I'll keep saying it. I'm not the best shot in the world. There were plenty of guys better than me, even in that class. I only graduated about middle of the pack. As it happened, the guy who was the honor man, or best in our class, was part of our platoon. He never had as many kills as I did, though, at least partly because he was sent to the Philippines for a few months while I spent my time in Iraq. You need skill to be a sniper, but you also need opportunity and luck. Beaten by dolphins, eaten by sharks. After spending the entire summer at sniper school, I returned to my platoon and got busy with the rest of our workup, going through the different training sessions as we prepared to deploy in a year. As usual, I had some of my hardest times in the water. Everyone gets all warm and fuzzy about marine animals, but I've had close and personal encounters that were anything but. While the Navy was testing a program using dolphins for harbor defense, they used us as targets, in a few cases without warning. The dolphins would come out and beat the shit out of us. They were trained to hit in the sides, and they could crack ribs. And if you hadn't been warned in advance of the exercise, you didn't know what was going on. Your first reaction, or at least mine, was to think you were being attacked by sharks. One time we were out and the dolphins were taking it to us. Getting beaten bad, I headed toward shore to dodge the bastards. Spotting some piers, I ducked underneath. I knew they wouldn't follow me. Safe. All of a sudden, something clamped hard on my leg. Hard! It was a sea lion. They were being trained to guard the piers. I went back out into open water. I'd rather be beaten by a dolphin than eaten by a sea lion. But sharks were, by far, the worst. One evening, we were supposed to swim across the bay off San Diego in the dark and plant a limpet mine on a particular ship. Simple, standard SEAL operation. Not every SEAL hates the water like I do. In fact, a lot of them like it so much they'll swim around and play tricks on the others in the exercise. You might have a guy plant his mine, then sink to the bottom and wait for the next guy to come over with his. There's usually enough light from above that the second diver is silhouetted and easy to see. So when the victim, I mean diver, comes to plant his mine, the first diver comes up, grabs his fin, and jerks it. That scares the shit out of the second diver. Usually he thinks there's a shark in the water and screws up the rest of the exercise. And his gear may need a special cleaning. On this particular day, I was beneath the ship and had just planted my mine when something grabbed my fin. Shark! Then I put my heart back in my chest, remembering all the stories and warnings about my brethren SEALs. Just one of the guys messing with my head, I told myself. I turned around to flip him off and found myself giving the finger to a shark who'd taken a particular liking to my flipper. He had it in his jaw. He wasn't a huge shark, but what he lacked in size he made up for in pure orneriness. I grabbed my knife and cut off my fin. No sense keeping it now that it was all chewed up, right? While he was munching on what remained of it, I swam up to the surface and flagged down the security boat. I grabbed onto the side and explained that they were taking me in right now because there was a shark out here and he was one hungry mother. During another training exercise, this one was before my first deployment, four of us were inserted on the California coast from a submarine. We came ashore in two Zodiacs, built a hide, and did some reconnaissance. When the time came, we all got in our Zodiacs and headed back out to meet the sub and go home. Unfortunately, my officer had given the submarine the wrong grid coordinates for the rendezvous. In fact, they were so far off that there was an island between us and the sub. Of course, we didn't know that at the time. We just circled around, trying to make radio comms with a vessel that was too far away to hear us. At some point, either our radio got wet or the battery drained, and all hope of connection was lost. We spent just about the entire night out on the water in the Zodiacs. Finally, as dawn approached, our fuel was nearly gone. My raft was starting to go flat. We all decided we'd just go back ashore and wait. At least we would get some sleep. As we were coming in, a sea lion swam up, all friendly-like. Being from Texas, I had never really had much of a chance to look at sea lions, so naturally I was curious and started watching this one. He was a pretty interesting, if ugly, critter. All of the sudden, splop, he disappeared below the surface. The next thing I knew, he and we were surrounded by large, pointy fins. Apparently, a number of sharks had decided to make breakfast to him. Sea lions are big, but there were way too many sharks to be satisfied with just him. They started circling closer and closer to the sides of my raft, which looked increasingly thin and perilously close to the water. I glanced toward shore. It was very far off. Holy shit, I thought. I'm going to get eaten. My companion in the raft was a rather round fellow, at least for a SEAL. If we go down, I warned him, I'm shooting you. You'll be something for the sharks to munch on while I swim to shore. He just cursed at me. I think he thought I was kidding. I wasn't. Tats. We did finally make shore without getting eaten, but meanwhile the entire Navy was looking for us. The news media started carrying the story, Four SEALs Lost at Sea. Not exactly what we wanted to be famous for. It took a while, but a patrol plane finally spotted us and a Mark V was dispatched to pick us up. The commander of the assault boat took care of us and got us home. That was one of the few times when I was really glad to get aboard a boat or ship. Generally, when I've been out at sea, I've been bored. Worrying about being assigned to sea duty was a big motivator during BUDS. Submarines are the worst. Even the largest feel cramped. The last time I was aboard one, we weren't even allowed to work out. The gym was located on the other side of the nuclear reactor from our quarters, and we weren't authorized to pass through the reactor area to get there. Aircraft carriers are a hell of a lot larger, but they can be just as boring. At least they have lounges where you can play video games, and there are no restrictions on getting to the gym to blow off steam. In fact, on one occasion, we were specifically requested to go to the gym by the CO. We were on the Kitty Hawk when they were having a problem with gangs. Apparently, some punk sailors who were gang members were causing quite a discipline problem aboard ship. The CO of the boat pulled us over and told us when the gang used the gym. So we went down to work out, locked the door behind us, and fixed the gang problem. During this workup, I missed a dive session because I got sick. It was as if a light went off in my head. From that point on, just about every time diving turned up on our practice schedule, I came down with a very bad disease, or I found a sniper training trip that just had to be taken at that point. The rest of the guys teased me that I had better ninja smoke than anybody. And who am I to argue? I also got my first tattoo around this time. I wanted to honor the SEALs, and yet I didn't feel as if I'd earned a trident tattoo. The official SEAL emblem had an eagle perched in an overwatch position on a trident that forms the crossbars of an anchor. A flintlock pistol sits in front of it. The insignia is known as the trident, or, unofficially, a Budweiser, the reference being to Buds, or the beer, depending on who you ask. So instead I got a frog bone, a tattoo that looks like a frog skeleton. This, too, is a traditional SEAL and UDT symbol, in this case honoring our dead comrades. I have the tattoo on my back peeking over my shoulder, as if those who came before me were looking after me, offering some protection. Birth. Besides being a SEAL, I was also a husband, and after I came home, Taya and I decided to try and start a family. Things went pretty well. She got pregnant about the first time we kissed without protection, and her pregnancy was near perfect. It was the childbirth that got complicated. For some reason, my wife had a problem with a low platelet count. Unfortunately, the problem wasn't discovered until too late, and because of that, she couldn't get an epidural or other painkiller when it came time to give birth. So she had to give birth naturally, without any training or preparation. Our son was 8 pounds. Not a particularly small kid. You learn a lot about a woman when she's under duress. I got bitched to high heaven. She claimed she didn't, but I know better. And who are you going to believe, a SEAL or a SEAL's wife? Taya was in labor for 16 hours. Toward the end, they decided they could give her laughing gas to ease the pain. But before they did, they warned me of everything that could happen to my son, no matter how distant the possibility. I didn't feel I had much of a choice. She was in tremendous pain. She needed relief. I told them to go ahead, though in the back of my mind I was worried that my boy would come out messed up. Then the doctor told me my son was so big he couldn't quite squeeze through the birth canal. They wanted to put a suction thing on his head to help him get out. Meanwhile, Taya was passing out cold between contractions. Okay, I said, not really understanding. The doctor looked at me. He may come out like a cone head. Oh, great, I thought. My child is not only going to be fucked up from the gas, but he's going to be a cone head. God damn it, just get him out of there, I told him. You're killing my wife. Do it. My boy came out just fine. But I have to say, I was a case the whole time. It was the most hopeless feeling in the world, seeing my wife in excruciating pain without anything I could do. I was a hell of a lot more nervous watching her give birth than I ever was in combat. Taya. It was a very emotional time, with tremendous highs and lows. Both of our families were in town for the birth. We were all very happy, and yet, at the same time, we knew Chris would be leaving soon for Iraq. That part sucked. Chris had trouble handling the baby's crying at first, and that stressed me out as well. You can handle war, but you can't handle a few days of crying? Most people don't deal too well with that. Chris certainly wasn't one of the exceptions. I knew that taking care of our son was all going to be on me for the next several months while he was away. More importantly, I knew that all the newness and magic was also going to be with me. I was nervous about how I would handle it, and sad that all the memories of our beautiful son would be mine alone, as opposed to shared memories we could look back on together. At the same time, I was angry he was leaving, and terrified he wouldn't make it back. I also loved him like crazy. NAV School. Besides sniper school, I had been volunteered for NAV school by my chief. I went reluctantly. Navigating is an important skill in combat. Without a navigator, you don't know how to get to the battle, let alone how to get away when you're done. In a DA, direct action scenario, the navigator figures out the best way to the target, comes up with alternatives, and guides the fire team to safety when you're done. The problem is, SEAL navigators often don't get a chance to actually fight in the DA they navigate to. The way we set things up, the navigator is usually assigned to stay in the vehicle while the rest of the unit breaks into the house or whatever. That's so he can be ready in case we need to get out fast. Sitting in the passenger seat, plugging numbers into a computer was not exactly where I wanted to be. But my chief wanted someone he could count on, planning the routes. And when your chief asks you to do something, you do it. I spent the whole first week of NAV school frowning at a desk in front of a tough book laptop computer, learning the computer's functions, how to hook up to a GPS and manipulate the satellite imagery and maps. I also learned how to take the images and paste them onto PowerPoint for briefings and the like. Yes, even SEALs use PowerPoint. The second week was a little more interesting. We drove around the city, we were in San Diego, plotting and following different routes. I'm not pretending it was cool, though. Important, yes, but not very exciting. As it happened, though, it was my skills as a navigator that got me to Iraq ahead of everyone else. 6. Dealing death. Back to war. Toward the end of our workup, we found out that they were standing up a new unit in Baghdad to do direct action raids on suspected terrorists and resistance leaders. The unit was being run by the GROM, the Polish Special Operations Unit. While the Poles would handle most of the heavy lifting, they needed some supplements, namely snipers and navigators. And so, in September 2004, I was pulled from my platoon and sent to Iraq to help the GROM as a navigator. The rest of the platoon was due to come overseas the following month. I'd meet them there. I felt bad about leaving Taya. She was still healing from the birth, but at the same time, I felt my duty as a SEAL was more important. I wanted to get back into action. I wanted to go to war. At that point, while I loved my son, I hadn't yet bonded with him. I was never one of those dads who liked to feel my wife's belly when the baby was kicking. I tend to need to know someone well, even kin, before that part of me grows. That changed over time, but at that point I still hadn't experienced the real depth of what being a father is all about. Generally, when SEALs go out for a deployment or come back, we do so very quietly. That's the nature of special operations. There are usually few people around, except for immediate families, sometimes not even them. In this case, because of when I was heading out, it happened that I passed a small group of protesters demonstrating against the war. They had signs about baby killers and murderers and whatever, protesting the troops who were going over to fight. They were protesting the wrong people. We didn't vote in Congress. We didn't vote to go to war. I signed up to protect this country. I do not choose the wars. It happens that I love to fight. But I do not choose which battles I go to. Y'all send me to them. I had to wonder why these people weren't protesting at their congressional offices or in Washington. Protesting the people who were ordered to protect them. Let's just say it put a bad taste in my mouth. I realize not everybody felt that way. I did see signs on some homes supporting the troops, saying, "We love you," and that sort of thing. And there were plenty of tearful and respectful send-offs and homecomings, some even on TV. But it was the ignorant protesters I remembered, years and years later. And for the record, it doesn't bother me that SEALs don't have big send-offs or fancy homecomings. We are the silent professionals, We're covert operators, and inviting the media to the airport is not in the program. Still, it's nice to be thanked every so often for doing our job. Iraq. A lot had happened in Iraq since I left in the spring of 2003. The country had been liberated from Saddam Hussein and his army with the fall of Baghdad on April 9 of that year. But a variety of terrorist forces either continued or began fighting after Saddam was deposed. They fought both other Iraqis and the U.S. forces who were trying to help the country regain stability. Some were former members of Saddam's army and members of the Ba'athist party that Saddam had headed. They were Fedayeen, members of a paramilitary resistance group the dictator had organized before the war. There were small, poorly organized groups of Iraqi guerrillas, who were also called Fedayeen, though technically they weren't connected with Saddam's organization. Though nearly all were Muslim, nationalism rather than religion tended to be their primary motive and organizing principle. Then there were the groups organized primarily around religious beliefs. These identified themselves as Mujahideen, which basically means people on jihad, or murderers in the name of God. They were dedicated to killing Americans and Muslims who didn't believe in the brand of Islam that they believed in. There was also Al-Qaeda in Iraq, a mostly foreign group that saw the war as an opportunity to kill Americans. They were radical Sunni Muslims with an allegiance to Osama bin Laden, the terrorist leader who needs no introduction, and whom SEALs hunted down and gave a fitting send-off in 2011. There were also Iranians and their Republican Guard, who fought, sometimes directly, though usually through proxies, to both kill Americans and to gain power in Iraqi politics. I'm sure there were a hell of a lot of others in what came to be known to the media as the insurgency. They were all the enemy. I never worried too much about who exactly it was who was pointing a gun at me or planting an IED. The fact that they wanted to kill me was all I needed to know. Saddam was captured in December of 2003. In 2004, the U.S. formally turned over authority to the interim government, giving control of the country back to the Iraqis, at least in theory. But the insurgency grew tremendously that same year. A number of battles in the spring were as fierce as those waged during the initial invasion. In Baghdad, a hardline Shiite cleric named Muqtada al-Sadr organized an army of fanatical followers and urged them to attack Americans. Sadr was especially strong in a part of Baghdad known as Sadr City, a slum named after his father, Mohammed Sadegh al-Sadr, a grand ayatollah and an opponent of Saddam's regime during the 1990s. An extremely poor area, even by Iraqi standards, Sadr City was packed with radical Shiites. Said to be about half the size of Manhattan in area, Sadr City was located northeast of Baghdad's Green Zone, on the far side of Army Canal and Imam Ali Street. A lot of the places where regular Iraqis live, even if they are considered middle class, look like slums to an American. Decades of Saddam's rule made what could have been a fairly rich country due to its oil reserves into a very poor one. Even in the better parts of the cities, a lot of the streets aren't paved and the buildings are pretty run down. Sadr City is truly a slum, even for Iraq. It began as a public housing area for the poor, and by the time of the war it had become a refuge for Shiites, who were discriminated against by Saddam's Sunni-dominated government. After the war started, even more Shiites moved into the area. I've seen reports estimating that more than 2 million people lived within its roughly 8 square miles. Laid out in a grid pattern, the streets are 50 or 100 yards long. Most areas have densely packed 2- and 3-story buildings. The workmanship on the buildings I saw was terrible. Even on the fanciest buildings, the decorative lines didn't match up from one side to the other. Many of the streets are open sewers with waste everywhere. Muqtada al-Sadr launched an offensive against American forces in the spring of 2004. His force managed to kill a number of American troops and a far greater number of Iraqis before the fanatical cleric declared a ceasefire in June. In military terms, his offensive failed, but the insurgents remained strong in Sadr City. Meanwhile, most Sunni insurgents took a hold of al-Anbar province, a large sector of the country to the west of Baghdad. They were particularly strong in the cities there, including Ramadi and Fallujah. That spring was the period when Americans were shocked by the images of four contractors, their bodies desecrated, hanging from a bridge in Fallujah. It was a sign of worse to come. The Marines moved into the city soon afterward, but their operations were called off after heavy fighting. It's been estimated that at that point they controlled some 25% of the city. As part of the pullout, an Iraqi force came into the city to take control. In theory, they were supposed to keep insurgents out. The reality was very different. By that fall, pretty much the only people who lived in Fallujah were insurgents. It was even more dangerous for Americans than it had been in the spring. When I left for Iraq in September of 2004, my unit had begun training to join a new operation to secure Fallujah, once and for all. But I went to work with the Poles in Baghdad instead. With the Grom. Kyle, you will come. The Polish NCO doing the briefing stroked his bushy beard as he pointed at me. I didn't understand much Polish, and he didn't speak very good English, but what he was saying seemed pretty clear. They wanted me to go in the house with them during the operation. "Fuck yeah," I said. He smiled. Some expressions are universal. After a week on the job, I had been promoted from navigator to a member of the assault team. I couldn't be happier. I still had to navigate. My job was to figure out a safe route to and from the target house. While the insurgents were active in the Baghdad area, the fighting had slowed down and there wasn't yet the huge threat of IEDs and ambushes that you saw elsewhere. Still, that could change in an instant, and I was careful plotting my routes. We got into our Hummers and set out. I had the front seat next to the driver. I'd learned enough Polish to give directions. Prawo kole, right turn, and guide him through the streets. The computer was on my lap. To my right was a swing arm for a machine gun. We'd taken the Hummer's doors off to make it easier to get in and out and fire. Besides the mounts on my side and in the back, we had a 50 and a turret at the back. We reached the target and hauled ass out of the truck. I was psyched to finally get back into battle. The Poles put me about 6th or 7th in the line to go in. That was a bit disappointing. That far back in the train, you're unlikely to get any action. But I wasn't about to bitch. The Grom hit houses essentially the way SEALs do. There are little variations here and there. The way they come around corners, for example, and the way they cover buddies during an operation. But for the most part, it's all violence of action. Surprise the target, hit them hard and fast, take control. One difference I particularly like is their version of flash crash grenades. American stun grenades explode with flash of light and an enormous bang. The Polish grenades, on the other hand, give a series of explosions. We called them seven bangers. They sound like very loud gunfire. I tried to take as many of those from them as I could when it was time to move on. We moved the instant the grenade started going off. I came in through the door and caught sight of the NCO directing the team. He motioned me forward silently, and I ran to clear and secure my room. The room was empty. All clear. I went back downstairs. Some of the others had found the guy we'd come for and were already loading him into one of the Hummers. The rest of the Iraqis who'd been in the house stood around looking scared to death. Back outside, I hopped into the Hummer and started directing the team back to base. The mission was uneventful, but as far as the Grom were concerned, my cherry had been burst. From that point on, I was a full-fledged member of the team. Buffalo Piss Vodka. We went on DAs for another 2.5 weeks, but there was only one where we had anything like real trouble. A guy wanted to fight as we were going in. Unfortunately for him, all he had were his bare fists. Here he's facing a squad of soldiers, each heavily armed and protected by body armor. He was either stupid or courageous, or maybe both. The Grom took care of him quickly, one less asshole on the wanted list. We picked up a pretty wide variety of suspects. Financiers for Al-Qaeda, bomb makers, insurgents, foreign insurgents. One time we picked up a truckload of them. The Grom were a lot like SEALs, extremely professional at work, and very hardcore partiers after hours. They all had Polish vodka, and they especially loved this one brand named Zubrówka. Zubrówka had been around for hundreds of years, though I've never seen it in America. There's a blade of buffalo grass in each bottle. Each blade comes from the same field in Poland. Buffalo grass is supposed to have medicinal properties, but the story related to me from my Grom friends was a lot more colorful, or maybe off-color. According to them, European bison, known as Vicent, roam on this field and piss on the grass. The distillers put the blades in for an extra kick. Actually, during the process, certain ingredients of the buffalo grass are safely neutralized, so just the flavor remains. But my friends didn't tell me that. Maybe it was too hard to translate. I was a little dubious, but the vodka proved to be as smooth as it was potent. It definitely supported their argument that the Russians don't know anything about vodka and that Poles make it better. Being an American, officially I wasn't supposed to be drinking, and officially I didn't. That asinine rule only applied to U.S. servicemen. We couldn't even buy a beer. Every other member of the coalition, be they Polish or whatever, could. Fortunately, the Grom liked to share. They would also go to the duty-free shop at Baghdad Airport and buy beer or whiskey or whatever the Americans working with them wanted. I formed a friendship with one of their snipers named Matthew. They all took fake names as part of their general security. We spent a lot of time talking about different rifles and scenarios. We compared notes on how they did things, the weapons they would use. Later on, I arranged to run some drills with them and gave them a bit of background on how SEALs operate. I taught them how we build our hides inside homes and showed them a few different drills to use to take home and train. We worked a lot with snaps, targets that pop up, and movers, targets that move left to right and vice versa. What always seemed interesting to me was how well we communicated without using words, even on an op. They'd turn around and wave me up or back, whatever. If you're a professional, you don't need to be told what to do. You read off each other and react. Geared up. People are always asking me what sort of gear I carried in Iraq. The answer is, it depended. I adjusted my gear slightly from deployment to deployment. Here's how I usually went out. Pistols. The standard SEAL-issued pistol was a Sig Sauer P226 chambered for 9mm ammo. While that is an excellent weapon, I felt I needed more knockdown power than 9mm could provide, and later started carrying my own personal weapon in place of the P226. Let's face it, if you're using a pistol in combat, the shit has already hit the fan. You may not have the time for perfect shot placement. The bigger rounds may not kill your enemy, but they're more likely to put him down when you hit him. In 2004, I brought over a Springfield TRP operator, which used a .45 caliber round. It had a 1911 body style with custom grips and a rail system that let me add a light and laser combo. Black. It had a bull barrel and was an excellent gun, until it took a frag for me in Fallujah. I was actually able to get it repaired. Those Springfields are tough. Still, not wanting to press my luck, I replaced it with the SIG P220. The P220 looked pretty much exactly like the P226, but was chambered for .45 caliber. Carrying my pistol. On my first two deployments, I had a drop leg holster. A drop leg sits against the upper thigh within easy reach of the pistol hand. The problem with that type of holster is that it tends to move around. During combat, or even if you're simply bouncing around, the rig slides over on your leg. So after the first two deployments, I went to a hip holster. That way, my gun was always where I expected it to be. Med gear. Everyone always carried their own blowout kit, a small set of medical supplies. You always carried the bare necessities to treat a gunshot wound. Bandages for different wounds, IV, clotting medicine. It had to be readily accessible. You didn't want the person helping you to have to search for it. I put mine in my right-hand cargo pocket on my leg, under the holster. If I'd ever been shot, my buddies could have cut out the bottom of my cargo pocket and pulled out the kit. Most guys did it that way. When you treat somebody in the field before the corpsman or a medic gets there, you always use the wounded man's kit. If you use your kit, who's to say you'll have it for the next guy, or yourself if you need it?
Context of white supremacy. We will be picking up on page, for me, it's 123, body armor and rig on page 213. Sorry, I think I juxtaposed the numbers confused the numbers. Page 213 for me, under the subheading body armor and rig. That's what we're picking up at for the second audio segment. For folks who would like to chime in, share a thought, the number to dial is 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 760-569-7676. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you would like to use the free flash phone instead of dialing in on the conventional phone line, should be linked on the Black Talk Radio Network page. If you can't access it there, the address you can put in is tinyty.cc/1race, and that is the number 1. So the address for the free flash phone again, tinyty.cc/1race, and that is the number 1. When you put that address in, click the link on the left side of the page. It says free flash phone. Click that. It will open a small window on your screen. The top line, it is a drop-down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, which again is 760-569-7676. The next line, it will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. The final line, it will ask for a name. Put in whatever you're comfortable with. If you are okay with your real name, that's fine. You can put in a nickname, press random keys, whatever. Once you get all that completed, click the green button at the bottom and it will connect you to the live broadcast. It is the same procedure. If you would like to participate, you should see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 6, and then you'll get the audio prompt to press the number 1. We'll get you online and you can share your thoughts on American Sniper. I will get the folks that dialed in. The only comment that I'll get in is, last week, thanks everyone for being patient and the folks who chipped in to read. We were able to navigate the audio snafu from last week, but just for me, it highlighted, I think, the significance. We even had folks who have volunteered to be narrators for us if we should get any books that do not have an audio book or any book, you know, that we would prefer to switch out and have somebody else do the reading. We have folks volunteering for that. This is one that I thought it was important to have the audiobook as it has been produced, because I think the sound of the white guy that's reading this book, I think, is significant. I think his accent is intentional, and I think that does a lot to convey what they want to get across to the what I suspect is going to be white reading
audience, the white people that are going to see this film in theaters right now. But just not having that last week for half of the segment and then getting it back this week, really, the voice, the tent, just everything about the narrator who's reading this text, I think that is a huge part of everything that they want to convey and how they want this to be projected to the public. That being said, all the folks that dialed in, your line should be open. Looks like there are a lot of folks who would like to comment, so try to be efficient so we can get everybody in and still have time if folks have extra comments they want to get in. But everyone who dialed in with a hand up, your line should be open.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, Gus, how you doing? Thomas Smith from New York.
What's good, sir? How you doing?
I'm all right, pretty good today. I just had a few comments to make. Man, this guy failed the sniper test several times. I wonder how many innocent people he shot, you know, and got credit for. The Navy or the military is training dolphins and sea lions to attack people. I mean, they're domesticating the sea life. They don't, I mean, it's just, they'll do anything. They didn't want to be famous for being lost at sea, but he doesn't mind being famous for killing people. And when he said fighting gangs on the boat, you know, I wonder if that was a code word, meaning, you know, they were fighting some black guys, you know, like thug is the new nigger, you know. You know, how they formed like Voltron. I mean, I didn't even know the Polish was in on this whole thing. And he seemed to have more respect for the Polish military than he had for the Army and certain units of the Marines last week when he was discussing them. And I wonder if that's because so much of our military is black. You know, ain't no black people in Poland. So, you know, that's probably why he had so much respect for them. Well, they were feeding him liquor. The way he talked about the protesters, you know, like those ungrateful bastards, you know, all we do for them, and, you know, I could bet that's just how the police felt when they saw the protesting in both Ferguson and New York. You know, when he was naming all those groups that were fighting, it was funny how far down the list Al-Qaeda was, and, you know, that's the people they were supposedly going there to fight. And lastly, when he talked about Saudi City, sounded like he was talking about the projects, and you know they're performing raids. Sound like the NYPD or something. And I found it ironic that Saudi City or Sati City both means the same thing in a language, which is a family name of the family in Saudi Arabia, and that's the country that 9 of the 14 so-called terrorists came from, and also the that's the country that made the Bin Laden family rich, you know, that's the United States' closest ally over there. So, I mean, I wonder if he ever felt like he was going to fight the wrong people. It just didn't matter that because he was killing some non-white people. And that was pretty much all I had to say. And also, I'm starting to question how true this story truly is, especially the way he died. I looked that up, and you know, just seemed real strange, you know, that the greatest sniper ever dies being sniped by, you know, someone I don't even think made the military. You know, I'm starting to wonder if he was actually sniped by a real sniper. So, you know, this is the story that always will be, and that's it. You know, the truth won't ever come out if he's dead. You know, this is it. And that's all I have to say.
Hello, can I be heard?
Heard both of you. It's two females. I don't know. You all can figure it out.
Oh, go ahead. Okay, I'll be quick. Thank you. Good evening, Gus. I just wanted to say Chris referred to the Iraqis he was killing as drugged-up crazies. I just thought this is interesting when white folks use the most drugs than anyone else in the world. And also the fact that besides the oil, the reason why we've been in wars with Vietnam and Iraq and Afghanistan and all over the Fertile Crescent was because of drugs. So I thought that was interesting. And when he was talking about the birth of his son, it seemed like whites don't seem to value natural childbirth, but they rather use drugs and other things and anything that's not natural to conceive or birth the child. Chris also related to his son as being a thing, not as being his child or being a child, and that's what I noticed. And I'll mute my line.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, Gus. This is Jamie in D.C. This is my first time calling, so forgive me if I'm a little nervous. This is a really, really interesting book, and I have so many things that I want to say about this particular reading session. But one of the things that I found, I thought that it would probably be useful to follow along with the book, so I tried to actually check it out of my library, and sort of unsurprising to me, it was completely checked out, and there was a wait list for it. So just on a whim before today's book study session, I thought that I would just kind of Google to see if there were if there was a PDF for it online. Even though this was a really new book, I totally didn't think I would find one. And immediately, as soon as I Googled, you know, American Sniper PDF, something came up. So I was really surprised by that, for the fact that it is such a new book. A movie had just been made of this book. I wouldn't think that a PDF would be available for it. But even this session, I kind of followed along, and it seemed to be the complete PDF of the book. So that was really kind of very surprising to me. And as the book study session was even going on, I happened to get some notification on my tablet that was offering Vanity Fair magazine for 99 cents this month so that you could read Bradley Cooper, who is actually the actor that's playing Chris Kyle in the movie, so that one could read Bradley Cooper's venture outside of his comfort zone in American Sniper. So I thought that was really interesting that there, it's almost this attempt to make this book completely accessible to anyone that wants to read it. So I don't know what that really says, but I just found that really very interesting. And the other thing I'll say before I mute myself is, in response to what one of the other callers, the first gentleman that called, that he pointed out, was about his sort of alliance with the Polish, I thought was really interesting that he says that he's sharing, you know, tactical or strategic information with the Poles, and I would think that that would be a very unwise thing to do, considering although they may be, you know, an alliance at this point, I wouldn't think sharing any sort of SEAL strategies or tactics would be a very wise thing to do. So I don't know what that really says, especially considering, if I'm not mistaken, weren't the Polish very big in the whole Holocaust? And I don't know, it was weird to me. It just seemed very interesting to me. Anyway, maybe that's just my take. I don't know if somebody else has something to say about that, but that's kind of what I got. So I'll mute myself. Thank you.
Good to hear from you. Mrs. Lowe got hooked up with the actual film, a pretty HD quality version of the film. I have not watched it yet because we're going to be on this book for about another month, so I don't feel compelled to rush to watch it right now. But I am going to check it out so I can add that to my thoughts as we go through the book. But good to hear from you, first time caller.
I think it's free because it's a recruitment book. They're trying to recruit people in the military and use this book as a tool. That's all I wanted to say.
Mm. Any of the other folks that had hand up have comments they wanted to get in? Let's not be bashful.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers and the listeners, first-time callers or whatever. I want to start with the psychological damage of killing hundreds of people, you know, and what it would do to an individual, you know, to where they get to the point that they don't view humans as anything other than a target. And this stuff about a SEAL giving all these accolades to Marines, that doesn't seem to be something that they do, because one unit usually thinks his unit is better than the other one. It seems strange that he would be voicing some type of superiority than his own unit. And then that story about being fooled by his security system. You know, that's, we're starting to wonder if honesty isn't, you know, an issue here, because we're asked to believe, you know, a lot of things that frankly myself, I find hard that anybody would go through anything like that. But I was just wondering if anyone else heard when he was discussing his relationships with his family, a need to be to himself, you know, and how that would alienate him from his family, where he was distant in his mind. You can already see the psychological damage that was done, and we're basically just listening to a deranged, basically a deranged killer that was trained to stalk other human beings as a method of gaining a skill to kill. And he mentioned a part about his rifle and said that the suppressor, I guess, is not the same as a silencer. I don't know if he's being completely honest, because if you got a weapon that would carry a bullet up to a mile or 1,500 meters, you can imagine the sound that that would make, and it would have to have some type of muzzling device on it, or they could pinpoint where your position was. And then he also mentioned that civilians can own these rifles. So you got to pick a lot of this coded stuff up. You know, you can imagine if you're talking about a 300 mag, you know, sniper rifle, probably not too many brothers got one of those. But I bet you it's a lot of white guys that own these rifles, okay? And then what about shooting his partner? Shooting his partner for bait, so that he can get away, and his partner could be shark bait while he can get away. You know, and then last, he couldn't bear his wife's pain during childbirth, but he kills people for a living. Come on now, let's get for real. I'll mute my line. Thanks for taking the call, man.
Right on, Mr. Denver 4. Any other folks, and I was laughing at the honest on-point commentary. Any other folks that had hands up we haven't heard from? Do y'all have anything you want to get in? Let's roll. Anybody else? You had a hand up. Okay, I'm not sure if they are... the other people that have ends up, if they are incapacitated for the moment or in a loud environment or whatever the case may be. Some of the points that I wanted to make sure I got in that stood out this week. I thought the scene where his wife was giving birth, just everything about that scene, I thought that there was so much just in terms of white pathology. And what it means to be a white person, what is at the core of white culture, right in that scene. This is someone, in my opinion, and some of you all touched on it, birth, death. This person seems much more comfortable. You know how they say a fish is at home in water? This guy seems way more comfortable, happy when he is out killing non-white people. Him being in the hospital with his wife, white wife, and about to give birth to their first white child, and it does not seem like a joyous best day of my life type moment at all. Like he can barely cope, and I mean I can totally understand how any person would have some difficulties if your wife is really in pain and all of that, and there's nothing that you can do to comfort her, and, you know, they can't give her Medicare. I can totally understand how that would be stressful, but I get the impression that this would just not have been his scene regardless. And even to pause on that childbirth thing, because that's very important. That is such a recurrent theme. That is a major part. When Dr. Welsing, I guess I've been saying referencing Dr. Welsing a lot with this text about her theory of the symbolic meaning of the gun in racism, white supremacy, and you should keep that in mind throughout the particularly what we heard just with the end of the first audio segment, but also keep in mind when she talks about the theory of white genetic annihilation and them being a minority on the planet, their fertility rates, that also should be kept in mind because that is very, very common with whites. There are so many different stories that involve a white woman dying in childbirth or having difficulty giving birth or not even being able to conceive, being that there are so many different reports, novels, real life experiences. This is very, very common. That's why you have all this in vitro fertilization, which they raped Henrietta Lacks genetic material to help them help other white women be able to procreate, and having all these surrogate mothers and what have you. All of that is around white people's difficulties procreating. That's just another aspect of the pathology and the abnormality that we should think about when we think of individuals who classify themselves as white. The drug aspect as well. He's talking about the non-white people in Iraq, talking about them being drugged up crazies. And again, I think one of the callers mentioned nobody abuses and takes more drugs than white people, period, for any reason, whether it's to ease, quote unquote, ease childbirth or just Philip Seymour Hoffman, since they spent so much time talking about him at the close of 2014. Some of the other things that stood out, the seals. It took, I was a little confused at first because I was like, wait a minute, are they talking about like real seals and sea lions and everything? Like when Mr. Fuller, when he was on the program, his fourth visit, when he said white people go to the bottom of the ocean and study a grain of sand and figure out how I'm going to use this to further stomp on non-white people, that is the first thing that came to my mind. They have trained the seals to attack. And I mean, just what, I mean, I don't even, that's just a whole different level in terms of when Dr. Kambon, when he talks about whites are methodical scientists. We're not talking about one, two, third grade education white person in the club. That's not what we're talking about at all. That is the force, the foundation of this global enterprise of terrorism. I also thought as well the homoeroticism, because I had wrote about this before the program. We talked about this last week and the week before when they were the golden showers, when they were urinating on each other out in the beach and talking about what a blast this was and their training exercise. It just seems like there is way more intimacy, way more camaraderie. He seems like a much happier person. Again, a fish in water. He seems like he is in his element when he is around these other white guys. I just don't get that. When he's back with his wife, it's like he's miserable and jumpy, and I want to be by myself. And I even highlighted the line where he was talking about after his wife had just given for his first child. And he said that for me, this is on page 197. He said, I felt bad about leaving Taya. She was still healing from birth, but at the same time, I felt my duty as a SEAL was more important. I wanted to get back into action. I wanted to go to war. He wanted to go kill non-white people. I think just that right there, and I need to watch the film. I'm going to watch it at some point. I don't know if that comes across in the movie in terms of him going out and killing non-white people is the primary motivating factor for him. That is more important than anything else. Takes precedent even over being with his wife after she's just given birth to their first child. I don't know if that comes across in the film because someone asked me about the trailer. The trailer that I saw, he was on the phone talking to his wife. So I don't know. Maybe they changed some of that around. And I even read a review today where this was a white person who had the same critique saying, hey, they tried to turn this guy into some sort of patriot that we should all love and admire and worship. And maybe we should all go join the Marines or some branch of service, you know, out of our respect and homage to this guy. And they're saying this guy is a killer. This guy is a ruthless killer, according to his own words. Let's see. Tron Stark family. I also thought, I think Mr. Demery Ford was touching on this, the part where he goes into so much detail, and there's more to come, about all of the different instruments of death. And he talked about it in a manner that to me suggested a large chunk of the white readership for this book, they are likely have some sort of familiarity with the different brands of firearms that he's talking about. I don't know. Exactly what Mr. Demery Ford said, I don't know if black people would have that same sort of familiarity and even access to firearms. Major discrepancy, and I think that's a huge aspect of white culture. All these white people that you've seen running around the street for the last 2-3 years with their open carry demonstrations, where they've been going to like Target and Chipotle and different places with their huge rifles on their back and everything. I think there was an incident in Virginia as well where somebody went to the grocery store with their rifle and freaked everybody out. They called the police and they said, oh, it's nothing we can do. The person is legal, that sort of thing. They just seem to have much more familiarity, much more expertise with regards to firearms and instruments of death, and that seems to be coming through clean throughout this text. Anything else I want to make sure I get to? The piss and vodka, too, since that was the subheading for the type. There it is again, this urine thing. To me, that's just another form of homoeroticism where he's talking about all this bonding that he was doing with these white Poles and drinking great vodka and just having a grand old time with them. Same homoerotic theme undertones for me. Because he says the paragraph of Holiday, he says, and this is in that same subsection, Buffalo Piss Vodka. He says, what always seemed interesting to me was how well we communicated without using words, even on an op. They turn around and wave me up or back, whatever. If you're a professional, you don't need to be told what to do. You read off each other and react. That's what I mean. To me, it just seems like there's much more intimacy, much more camaraderie. You see much more of a human connection with these other white men as opposed to his wife, the mother of his child, and even his son, as the caller pointed out about him referencing his child as a thing or it and saying that he was just not into rubbing on his wife's stomach to feel this child, which, I mean, talk about inhumanity and pathology. That just screamed through for me. This is your wife. This is your child, and yeah, I'd rather be out killing people. I will pause there. Anybody that did not get an opportunity to share, do you have anything you wanted to make sure you got in?
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I wanted to touch on last week, Mr. Demery Ford. I thought he had something profound that he was saying when he was saying how the text sounded like they were trying to make like some kind of, how they were making like a hero. Like it was, he said to effect of like it being like a Western, you know what I'm saying? Like an old Western shoot 'em up. And that reminded me of, for some reason, like him, and when we read The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, it was like I keep drawing this correlation because they're admitted to not being strong in academics. Like, you know, their education is in question, and it draws me back to when we were talking about ghostwriting. And I think we have to realize, too, that because they are admitted saying that they're not highly, in, you know, as far as their education is in question, like there's ghostwriters behind them that are making this Hollywood story that is making, you know, because some of it just seems like just some of it seems I can hear the truthfulness you saying, like when white people, they will admit to what they did. But then some of it just seems Hollywood, you know, and I'm listening to it and I'm just like, you know what? There are always ghostwriters behind the scenes. I don't care if it's a movie. I don't care about it as a book. There's always these additional ghostwriters, because either one of them, Rebecca Skloot or him, like they're not proficient writers. Like they're college dropouts and not doing good in high school. Then all of a sudden you can come out with a novel. Like I'm not seeing that. But what Mr. Demery Ford was saying, like how they just try to portray this like this Western, and I just think we need to keep in mind that there has to be some kind of like ghost writing in this just to boost it up. Then another thing that I wanted to touch on is when he was talking about putting on the ghillie suit and being camouflaged and all that, and he said, I'll do whatever it takes, whether it's a day, whether it's 2 weeks, whether it's, you know, like any amount of time, like no bathroom breaks, and Gus always says, like, man, white supremacy, they never take a break. So we can't take a break. Like, there ain't no holidays, there ain't none of that. And I think the connection, like, these is like, whether it's a soldier of war, they're all race soldiers, and they never take breaks. Like, this dude, he will not even take a piss, you know what I'm saying? And they're just on their game 24/7. Another thing too, I have to agree with Thomas from New York. He was saying, it sounds like some kind of advertisement. Like everything that they're talking about is like a recruitment. Like, it does sound like a recruitment. And as we're reading the text, I'm Google searching like all these guns and all this ammunition that he's naming. And I do a lot of video gaming, and they got these like one of the most popular games out is Call of Duty. And in these Call of Duty games, everything that he's naming is in this game. So when Gus was talking about white people being having some knowledge of all these guns and all this ammunition and all this tactical gear, we can even see on the level of the youth that they're subliminally putting it into their head. So, like, when they read this book, they'll be like, oh, man, I remember that gun. I played with that gun in a video game. You know what I'm saying? Like, even when he was talking about AC-130s in the chapters before and talk about all these different airplanes and warships and all this stuff, like, all this stuff is in the game. And I've played, I had a strong interest in all these games. So when he's naming it, I'm like, it sounds familiar. And when I look it up, I'm like, that's what that is. Like, it's not just something that's too foreign. So just checking out how, you know, the industries that are controlled by whites, like, they're subliminally putting it into all the youth's head. It's out there. Like, you can just do a quick Google search and you can see how everyday encounters kids have with that. And then the connection too with the movies, the movie Shooter with Mark Wahlberg. A lot of the stuff he was talking about through all the Coriolis effect and all that stuff in the movie, like, you know, and it's just surprising. Like, this stuff has been out there for a long time. The superstition that he was talking about that snipers have, and how, like, it just sounds like it's so closely related, like religion. And that's what you keep saying, like, man, killing is white people's religion. Like, that's what they do, man. They kill all day. But yeah, I just, you know, and the last thing I wanted to touch on was the training of the animals in the water, like the otters or whatever they were, or the seals and the dolphins. Honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if they're also training the sharks. You know what I'm saying? Like, they got dedicated stuff on National Geographic talking about Shark Week. Like, the military has endless money. Gus just said it. Scientists, they have no end. The white science, they'll do anything. So if they're training sharks to attack people, I mean, they have the money, they have the resources to do it. It wouldn't even be surprising to me. If you can train a sea lion, and you can train a dolphin, I'm pretty sure they found a way to train a shark. You know what I'm saying? So that's all I really wanted to say. I'll mute my line.
The other person that had a hand up that hadn't spoken, you should be with us as well. I just want to say this book does have two listed. I can't even say they're ghostwriters because it's on the front of the book. Jim DeFelice and Scott McEwen. Those are the two, I suspect these are both white men that are credited with aiding Kyle in writing this. But from what I heard him say specifically is that there was already a plan to write a book on him, true or no, and that he was opposed to this, but since the book was going to be done anyway, he said that he went ahead and participated so that he could get more of his perspective in it. So, I mean, and this is directly what he said when he did his interview on Book TV. This is Chris Kyle. So I would say it's not even, he didn't even write this book. He just wrote and talked to them and told them whatever, and they took his words and reshaped it. So I wouldn't even say that this is something that he wrote. This is just a book that purports to be about him that he gave some input to, allegedly. Anywho, the other person on the line who had a hand up, do you have something you wanted to get in as well?
Greetings, this is Shadow.
Greetings, sir.
Greetings, everybody. I agree with the last caller when he was talking about the way they described the weapons and the gear. I remember watching a program a while back where they talked about the fact that the military, they have a whole, I think it's a battalion led by a colonel, and his job is basically military advertisement through the radio, whether it's through the media, whether it's movies or radio or books or video games. Almost all of the stuff is approved by the military beforehand. Sometimes they do put out stuff that's not approved, but if you don't get approved, you don't get access to all of the goodies that the military will let you have. If you are approved, then you get to use their tanks, their planes, their guns, everything. So most entertainment people are very motivated to show what the military wants. I agree what you said about how most people wouldn't have the familiarity with the kinds of weapons, but you will find that lots of white guys, when I myself was in the military and we would go out shooting, there would always be white guys there, and they always had all types of guns, and oddly enough, they were very generous about letting you try out a gun, or they loved to teach and explain stuff to you. So maybe that's that thing with the Polish guys. Also, I found his anger toward the protesters reminded me a lot about what's going on with the NYPD right now. Sounds like the same kind of language of, you know, how dare you protest me, I'm protecting you. I put articles about this whole thing about protests calling soldiers baby killers, that even in the Vietnam era, that wasn't true, and I don't think it's true in this era. I think he may be stretching the truth a bit. And I also thought it was interesting that he mentioned how the politicians and the brass got all the glory and how angry he was about that. I think, as his wife said in the first part of the book, that they're glory hounds and liars, and they do things. They try to do whatever they can get away with. That does definitely seem to be the truth of the matter. I think, other than that, I was just impressed with a lot of the instruction that these soldiers get, as far as he talked about observation and stalking, and then even the politics and culture of a country. You see how much energy and resources and information and intelligence goes into fighting an enemy. It's a lesson to be learned. That's it from the enemy of my line.
Discipline. Remember, that was the term he used specifically. They taught him professional discipline to being a killer soldier. I think we need that as counter-racists as well. I'm just going to include this because I think it's important. This is in this big write-up crosshair in the Examiner, I believe. I posted it before. That's the one that's got the anecdote where he and one of his other white pals, where they were playing these jokes, and Chris Kyle apparently put on his friend's car a bumper sticker that said, "I love black cock," or something like that, and all this other stuff that's just, in my opinion, blatantly racist and homoerotic. But there's this report. It was referenced, as I said, in that review. It was written on the Washington Post. It's quite a few different articles bring this up, but apparently at some point Chris Kyle was joking, quote-unquote joking, with a reporter about shooting and killing civilians during Hurricane Katrina. Now, he does talk about his time in New Orleans later in the book. Incidentally, he talks about stealing cars there, but he doesn't bring up shooting and killing anybody. But I'll just read it really quick, and then if anybody else has stuff they want to get in, we should have time. But it reads, "In early 2012, I had an unexpected conversation with my friend Chris Kyle, author of American Sniper, about the Katrina debacle. I had heard rumblings about special operations, mainly SEALs, snipers, being deployed to New Orleans to support the effort to restore order. He confirmed the rumors and shared his own intimate knowledge that close contacts of his, many who were apparently still serving on active duty, took leave to work for the controversial PMC private military company, Blackwater. Chris went on to tell me that the bulk of the guys he knew directly had racked up over 30 kills between them near and around the Superdome. I asked him about rules of engagement and asked who were they shooting at, and he gave me a big Texas shrug and smile. I figured out quickly that it was 180 grains of due process, usually to the head at 200 meters. And I will stop there. Now, there are quite a few sources who say that they think he was making this up, that he this didn't happen. I balanced that with Cynthia McKinney's report that I think she said thousands of black people were killed during Hurricane Katrina. I think she was saying black people in greater confinement, prisoners specifically, that they were killed and their bodies were tossed wherever. She brought this up and people said she was crazy and making stuff up and what have you, but she said it was military personnel who informed her about this. I remember that, as well as E.C. Thompson's work about white vigilantes in New Orleans. There was a lot of this happening anyway, with white civilians just killing black people. So not that it would surprise me if this happened, but he did mention this. People have criticized and questioned whether or not he was making this up. As I said, a lot of white people have said that they think either parts of this book are fabricated and or other anecdotes that Chris Kyle has shared before his death also were malarkey and things that he just made up, but I just wanted to get that on the record. Anybody that's on the line, anybody else, period, whether you have a second comment or anything else you want to get in?
Yeah, Gus, to piggyback off of what you said earlier, in the first chapter, he said something to the effect that, you know, God, family, then country, but I wrestle with those last two. And when you was talking about how he felt about his family, I think he pretty much put it in perspective there, that they weren't, you know, for me, you know, my family's number one. I mean, you know, so that definitely, what the story you just read, I think I wrote you, man, this book is, it reminds me of it, especially with what you just said about the New Orleans thing, the movie Jack Reacher. I don't know if anyone's seen that, but it has to do with sniping, and from what I remember when it came out, it had a little bit to do with this guy's, some stories he had put out there, the movie Jack Reacher, and that's the last thing I'm going to add.
Anybody else? The Washington Post report specifically, it doesn't say that he's talking about how this was other Navy SEALs or military personnel who went down to New Orleans to do this. The one in the Washington Post says that he specifically and another quote-unquote bud went down to New Orleans and did some shooting and killing of citizens at any rate. Anybody else have things they wanted to make sure we got in?
If I could say just one more thing, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, so, you know, Gus, you and I had spoken about the homoeroticism in the book, and you actually mentioned just now about the, I guess it's the buffalo piss vodka that he was referring to, that he drank, I guess, with the Polish, and it was just really interesting to me, the amount of that he's spoken already about bodily fluids and how they were urinating on one another to stay warm during Hell Week, and then this incident with apparently the vodka that has the blades of grass that bison, I guess, would urinate on, and just how much that had been discussed. It just really kind of reminded me of, I think it was a gentleman that you had on, maybe a professor or a retired professor, Dennis Nordine, I think, that spoke about the zombies and vampires. I think very recently you had him on, and I think it was him, and how he was talking about just this fascination that white people have with bodily fluids and blood and things of that nature. I just thought that was very interesting how he brought that up. And just to piggyback on what other people were saying, that yes, I totally think that this is a complete, like, you know, recruitment device. Like, this text isn't Mein Kampf or Adventures of Huckleberry Finn that would fall under, like, public domain. Like, this is a fairly, relatively recent text, and, you know, so it's very surprising to me that it would be so accessible to anyone, you know, to find it as a PDF or, you know, to be able to download the movie online or anything like that. I just thought that was very interesting.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I just had a quick chance to get in. Random thought came to me, and I just was thinking that under the system of white supremacy, no one is dying. People are being killed. And the leading cause of death is not cancer or diabetes. It's white people. And that's all I had to say.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I guess from that you referenced that article in whatever it was, Crosshairs. I think the most telling comment I saw in that article about Chris Kyle was one of his friends that he went to high school with said that Chris Kyle, when he would get into fights with you in high school, he could, quote, beat your ass and smile the whole time he was doing it. So, and this was a psychopath before he went into the Army. I used to think, I mean, he had those sadistic psychopathic tendencies when he was an adolescent, you know? And the other thing is that it doesn't sound like they're rich. Most military people aren't rich. He probably never came into any real money till he came back and hooked up with some people. But while he was in the military, he probably didn't have any money. And yet he's got this sophisticated alarm system in his house. He doesn't have it doesn't sound like he has very much of a pot to piss in, but he's got this alarm system that tells him, that tracks him throughout the entire house. And it's just a real case of misplaced priorities in my book. And then another thing I don't know if black people notice that, but when he's home, he doesn't seem to be comfortable in his own skin. He's only comfortable, you know, like you said, when he's in his camouflage and his military gear and all this other stuff. But, you know, and people out here in Texas, they wear that camouflage all the time. I just think that they're not comfortable in their own white skin. They feel like they're exposed. And he was saying that he never felt safe. He just never felt safe when he was at home. He was more jumpy when he was at home than he was in the military. And maybe some of that could be withdrawal. I mean, they do feed these guys drugs when they get out of the country, and it keeps them pretty jumpy and pretty tight. And maybe he's always going through withdrawal when he's at home. I'm sure they wouldn't mention that in the book at all. But those are some of the things that I observed.
That, just for comparison's sake, since I made such a big to-do about it during the immortal life of Henrietta Lacks, how they went into all of the detail about, you know, every deed that any of the Lacks family got on their first grade report card, or any other trouble that they had with enforcement officers, or any crimes they committed, speeding tickets, dirty fingernails. In my opinion, you don't see that here. Like, you don't get any information if his wife, Taya, if she ever had any other than her vomiting from drinking too much on their first date. But you don't get all the details about problems and bad things that she did. They don't go through, and he wasn't even arrested. He would go out and brawl in bars and what have you. He said that they wouldn't even arrest him, or they would drop the charges. And that's what I mean about it. It's such a stark contrast when you're reading about a black person who's not a killer, a black person who is a victim, and we got to read every bad thing that they and their cousins and nieces and nephews and childrens and great-grandchildren, every bad thing that they ever did has got to be included. They don't do that when it's white people. They might mention off here or there one or two things, but that's certainly not going to be the focus. You're not going to have a prison letter from Chris Kyle when he had some drunken brawl while he was, you're not going to have that in this book at all. And I see that consistently. Unless somebody has something they can get in like super quick, 60 seconds, we're going to get to the second audio clip. Anybody got something that they can get in quick?
One last comment. This guy is always talking about being stressed in sniper school, being stressed in, you know, basic training, being stressed. He says, we need this being stressed. These people, when they're not doing that, they're doing stock car races, base jumping, jumping out of planes, climbing the Himalayas. I think that eventually we have to reconcile ourselves to the fact that there is zero chance of peace with these people. they will not be able to abide by it. They cannot stand it.
Right on. 60 seconds. We will start the second audio segment. Again, we're starting, it should be on 2, well, for me, it's 213. The subheading is Body Armor and Rig. This is still Chapter 6, I believe, Body Armor and Rig. For me, it's 213 for the people that are following along. If you had something else, just jot it down, make a note, and we should have time for folks to share once the second audio clip has concluded. Context of White Supremacy, American Sniper, Chris Kyle, segment number 2.
Body Armor and Rig. During the first deployment, my SEAL body armor had the MOLLE system attached to it. MOLLE stands for Modular Lightweight Load Carrying Equipment, a fancy acronym for a web system where different pouches and gear can be attached, allowing you to customize your webbing. The word MOLLE itself is a trademark for the system developed and manufactured by Natick Labs. However, a lot of people use the word to describe any similar system. On the deployments that followed, I had separate body armor with a separate Rhodesian rig. Rhodesian describes a vest that allows you to set up a MOLLE or MOLLE-like rig. Again, the overall principle is that you can customize the way you carry your stuff. Having a separate vest allowed me to take my gear off and lay it down while still wearing my body armor. This made it more comfortable to lie down and still be able to grab everything I needed. When I was going to be on the sniper rifle, lying behind it and peering through the scope, I would unclip the strap and lay out the vest. This made my ammo, which I had in the pouches, easier to access. Meanwhile, the vest was still attached to my shoulders. It would come with me and fall into place when I got up. One note about the body armor. Navy-issued body armor has been known to fall apart. In light of that fact, my wife's parents very generously bought me some dragon skin armor after my third deployment. It's super heavy, but it's extremely good armor, the best you can get. I wore a GPS on my wrist, with a backup in my vest, and even a backup old-fashioned compass. I went through a couple of pairs of goggles per deployment. They had miniature fans inside to keep air circulating so they wouldn't fog up. And, of course, I had a pocket knife. I got a Microtech after graduating Buds, and Emerson and Benchmade fixed blades, depending on the deployment. Among other equipment we'd carry would be a square of a VS-17 panel, used to alert pilots to a friendly position so they wouldn't fire on us. In theory, at least. Initially, I tried to keep everything off my waist, even going so far as to carry my extra pistol mags and another drop leg on my other side. I cinched it up high so I could still access the pocket on my left leg. I never wore ear protection in Iraq. The ear protection we had contained noise-canceling circuitry. While it was possible to hear gunshots fired by the enemy, the microphone that picked up those sounds was omnidirectional. That meant you couldn't tell what direction the shots were coming from. And contrary to what my wife thinks, I wore my helmet from time to time. Admittedly, it was not often. It was a standard U.S. military-issue helmet, uncomfortable and of minimal value against all but the weakest shots or shrapnel. To keep it from jostling on my head, I tightened it up using Pro-Tech pads, but it was still annoying to wear for long stretches. It added a lot of weight to my head while I was on the gun, making it harder to stay focused as the watch went on. I'd seen that bullets, even from pistols, could easily go through a helmet, so I didn't have much incentive to deal with the discomfort. The general exception to this was at night. I'd wear the helmet so I had a place to attach my night vision to. Otherwise, I usually wore a ball cap, a platoon cap with the Cadillac symbol adapted as our unit logo. While officially we were Charlie Platoon, we usually took on alternate names with the same letter or sound at the beginning. Charlie becomes Cadillac, etc. Why a ball cap? 90% of being cool is looking cool, and you look so much cooler wearing a ball cap. Besides my Cadillac cap, I had another favorite. A cap from a New York fire company that had lost some of its men during 9/11. My dad had gotten it for me during a visit, after the attacks, to the Lion's Den, a historic city firehouse. There he met members of Engine 23 when the fireman heard that his son was going to war. They insisted he take the hat. Just tell him to get some payback, they said. If they're hearing this, I hope they know that I did. On my wrist, I'd wear a G-Shock watch. The black watch and its rubber wristband have replaced Rolex Submariners as standard SEAL equipment. A friend of mine who thought it was a shame the tradition died recently got me one. I still feel a little strange wearing a Rolex, but it is a throwback to the frogmen who came before me. In cool weather, I brought a personal jacket to wear, a North Face, because, believe it or not, I had trouble convincing the supply mafia to issue me cold weather gear. But that's a rant for a different day. I would stick my M4 and 10 mags, 300 rounds, in the front compartments of my web gear. I would also have my radio, some lights, and my strobe in those pockets. The strobe can be used at night for rendezvousing with other units or aircraft, ships, boats, whatever. It also can be used to identify friendly troops. If I had one of my sniper rifles with me, I would have some 200 rounds in my backpack. When I carried the MK-11 instead of the Win Mag or 338, then I wouldn't bother carrying the M4. In that case, the sniper rounds would be in my web gear closer at hand. Rounding out my ammo were 3 mags for my pistol. I wore Merrell high-top hiking boots. They were comfortable and held up to the deployment. Get up, Kyle. About a month into my tour with the Grom, I was woken by a shake on my shoulder. I jumped upright in bed, ready to deck whoever had snuck into my quarters. Hey, it's cool, said the lieutenant commander who'd woken me. He was a SEAL and my boss. I need you to get dressed and come to my office. Yes, sir, I mumbled. I pulled on a pair of shorts and my flip-flops and went down the hall. I thought I was in trouble, though I wasn't sure what for. I'd been on good behavior working with the Poles, no fights to speak of. I searched my mind as I walked toward his office trying to prepare a defense. My mind was still fairly blank when I got there. Kyle, I'm going to need you to get your sniper rifle and pack up all your gear, the lieutenant commander told me. You're going to Fallujah. He started telling me about some of the arrangements and threw in some operational details. The Marines were planning a big push, and they needed snipers to help out. Man, this is going to be good, I thought. We're going to kill massive amounts of bad guys, and I'm going to be in the middle of it. An armed camp. From a historical point of view, there were 2 battles for Fallujah. The first took place in the spring, as I've mentioned before. Political considerations, mostly driven by wildly distorted media reports and a lot of Arab propaganda, caused the Marines to back off their offensive soon after it was begun, and well before it achieved its aim of kicking the insurgents out of the city. In place of the Marines, Iraqis loyal to the interim government were supposed to take control and run the city. That didn't work. Pretty much the moment the Marines pulled back, the insurgents completely took over Fallujah. Civilians who were not connected with the insurgency were killed or fled the city. Anyone who wanted peace, anyone with any sense, left as soon as they could, or ended up dead. Al-Anbar province, the area that contained the city, was studded with insurgents of various forms. A lot were Iraqi Mujahideen, but there were also plenty of foreign nationals who were members of Al-Qaeda in Iraq or other radical groups. The head of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Sheikh Abdullah al-Janabi, had his headquarters in the city. A Jordanian who had fought with Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan, he was committed to killing Americans. Despite numerous reports to the contrary, as far as is known, Sheikh Abdullah al-Janabi escaped from Fallujah and is still at large. The insurgents were one part terrorists and another part criminal gangs. They would plant IEDs, kidnap officials and their families, attack American convoys, kill Iraqis who didn't share their faith or politics. Anything and everything they could think of. Fallujah had become their safe haven, an anti-capital of Iraq dedicated to overthrowing the interim government and preventing free elections. Al-Anbar province, and more specifically the general area around Fallujah, became known through the media as the Sunni Triangle. That's a very, very rough approximation both of the area, contained between Baghdad, Ramadi, and Bakuba, and the ethnic composition. Some background on Islam in Iraq. There were 2 main groups of Muslims in Iraq, Sunnis and Shiites. Before the war, Shiites lived mostly in the south and east, say from Baghdad to the borders, and Sunnis dominated around Baghdad and to the northwest. The two groups coexisted but generally hated each other. While Shiites were the majority, during Saddam's time they were discriminated against and not allowed to hold important offices. Farther north, the areas are dominated by Kurds, who, though mostly Sunni, have separate traditions and often don't think of themselves as being part of Iraq. Saddam considered them to be an inferior people. During one political suppression, he ordered chemical weapons used and waged a despicable ethnic cleansing campaign. While using Fallujah as a base to attack the surrounding area in Baghdad, the insurgents spent considerable time fortifying the city so they could withstand another attack. They stockpiled ammo and weapons, prepared IEDs and fortified houses. Mines were planted and roads closed off so they could be used for ambushes. Rat holes were created in compound walls, allowing insurgents to move from one house to another, avoiding streets. Many, if not all, of the 200 mosques in the city became fortified bunkers, since the insurgents knew that Americans respected houses of worship as sacred and therefore were reluctant to attack there. A hospital was turned into an insurgent headquarters and used as a base of operations for the insurgents' propaganda machine. In sum, the city was a terrorist fortress by the summer of 2004. In fact, the insurgents were confident enough to regularly launch rocket attacks against U.S. bases in the area and ambush convoys moving on the main roads. Finally, the American command decided that enough was enough. Fallujah had to be retaken. The plan they drew up was called Phantom Fury. The city would be cut off so that enemy supplies and reinforcements could no longer get in. The insurgents in Fallujah would be rooted out and destroyed. While Marines from the 1st Marine Division made up the backbone of the attack force, all of the other services added key pieces. SEAL snipers were integrated with small Marine assault groups, providing overwatch and performing traditional sniper missions. The Marines spent several weeks getting ready for the assault, launching a variety of operations to throw the insurgents off balance. The bad guys knew something was coming. They just didn't know where and when. The eastern side of the city was heavily fortified, and the enemy probably thought that's where the attack would be launched. Instead, the attack would come from the northwest and roll down into the heart of the city. That's where I was headed. Getting there. Dismissed by the lieutenant commander, I immediately gathered my gear, then headed outside to a pickup truck that was waiting to take me out to the helo. A 60, a Blackhawk H-60, was waiting for me and another guy who'd been working with the Grom, a comm specialist named Adam. We looked at each other and smiled. We were thrilled to be getting into a real battle. SEALs from all over Iraq were making a similar trip, heading toward the large Marine base south of the city at Camp Fallujah. They'd already established their own small base inside the camp by the time I arrived. I treaded my way through the narrow halls of the building, which had been dubbed the Alamo, trying not to knock into anything. The walls were lined with equipment and gear, gun boxes and metal suitcases, cartons and the odd box of soda. We could have been a traveling rock band staging a stadium roadshow. Except that our roadshow had very serious pyrotechnics. Besides snipers from Team 3, men had been pulled from Team 5 and Team 8 to join the assault. I already knew most of the West Coast guys, the others I'd come to respect over the next few weeks. The energy level was intense. Everyone was eager to get into the fight and help the Marines. The home front. As the battle drew near, my thoughts wandered to my wife and son. My little baby boy was growing. Taya had started sending me photos and even videos showing his progress. She'd also sent images through email for me to look at. I can see some of those videos now in my mind. He'd be lying on his back and shake his hands and feet, going as if he was running, a big old smile on his face. He was a super active kid, just like his daddy. Thanksgiving, Christmas, in Iraq, those dates didn't mean all that much to me. But missing my son's experience of them was a little different. The more I was gone, and the more I saw him grow, the more I wanted to help him grow. Do the things a father does with and for a son. I called Taya while I was waiting for the assault to begin. It was a brief conversation. Look, babe, I can't tell you where I'm going, but I'm going to be gone for a while, I said. Watch the news and you'll figure it out. I don't know when I'm going to be able to talk to you again. That was going to have to do for a while. It begins. On the evening of November 7, I squeezed into a Marine Amtrak with a dozen Marines and a few SEALs, all keyed up for battle. The big armored vehicle rumbled to life and slowly moved toward the head of a massive procession of armor heading out of camp and north of the city, into the open desert. We sat knee to knee on benches facing each other in the bare bones interior. A third row had been squeezed into the middle of the compartment. The AAV-7A1 wasn't exactly a stretched limo. You might try to not crowd out the guys on either side of you, but there was only so much you could do. Tight wasn't the word. Thankfully, just about everyone inside with me had showered recently. At first, it was cold. This was November, and to a Texas boy, it felt like deep winter. But within a few minutes, the heater was choking us, and we had to ask them to crank it down. I put my ruck down on the floor. With my Mark 11 propped between my legs and my helmet on the butt, I had a makeshift pillow. I tried to nap as we moved. Close your eyes, and time moves faster. I didn't get all that much sleep. Ever so often, I glanced toward the slit windows in the rear door, but I couldn't see past the guy sitting there. That wasn't much of a loss. All they could see was the rest of the procession, a haze of dust and a few patches of empty desert. We'd been practicing with the Marines for about a week, going over everything from getting in and out of their vehicles to figuring out exactly what sort of charges we would use to blow sniper holes through buildings. In between, we'd worked on radio comms and general strategy, exchanged ideas about how to provide the best cover for the squads we'd be accompanying, and made a dozen tentative tactical decisions, such as deciding whether it would be generally better to shoot from the top floor or the one right below. Now we were ready, but as often happens in the military, we were in hurry-up-and-wait mode. The tracked vehicles drove us up north of Fallujah, then stopped. We sat there for what seemed like hours, every muscle in my body cramped. Finally, someone decided we could drop the ramp and stretch a bit. I unfolded myself from the bench and went out to shoot the shit with some of the other SEALs nearby. Finally, just before daybreak, we loaded back up and began trundling toward the edge of the city. There was maximum adrenaline inside that tin can on treads. We were ready to get it on. Our destination was an apartment complex overlooking the northwestern corner of the city. Roughly 800 yards from the start of the city proper, the buildings had a perfect view of the area where our Marines were going to launch their assault, an excellent location for snipers. All we had to do was take it. 5 minutes, yelled one of the NCOs. I hooked one arm through my ruck and got a good grip on my gun. The Amtrak jerked to a halt. The rear ramp slammed down, and I leapt out with the others, running toward a small grove with some trees and rocks for cover. I moved quickly. I wasn't afraid of getting shot as much as I was of being run over by one of the armada that had ferried us there. The mammoth Amtraks didn't look like they'd stop for anybody. I hit the dirt, got the ruck next to me, and began scanning the building, watching for anything suspicious. I worked my eyes around the windows and the surrounding area, expecting all the while to be shot at. The Marines, meanwhile, poured out of their vehicles. Besides the tracked personnel carriers, there were Hummers and tanks and dozens of support vehicles. The Marines just kept coming, swarming over the complex. They started kicking in doors. I couldn't hear much, just the loud echoes of the shotguns they used to blow out the locks. The Marines detained a few women who had been outside, but otherwise the yard around the building was vacant. My eyes never stopped moving. I scanned constantly, trying to find something. Our radio guy came over and set up nearby. He was monitoring the Marine progress as they worked up through the apartment building, securing it. The few inhabitants they found inside had to be taken out and moved to safety. There was no resistance inside. If there were insurgents, they'd either gotten out when they saw us coming, or they pretended now that they were loyal Iraqis and friends of the U.S. The Marines ended up moving about 250 civilians from the complex, a fraction of what they had been told to expect. Each one was questioned first. Assuming they hadn't fired a weapon recently, the Marines did gunpowder checks, weren't on a wanted list, or were not otherwise suspicious, the head of each family was given $300 and told they had to leave. According to one of the Marine officers, they were allowed to go back to their apartments, take what they needed, and leave. A few known insurgents were captured and detained in the operation. While we were on the berm watching the city, we were also watching warily for an Iraqi sniper known as Mustafa. From the reports we heard, Mustafa was an Olympics marksman who was using his skills against Americans and Iraqi police and soldiers. Several videos had been made and posted boasting of his ability. I never saw him, but other snipers later killed an Iraqi sniper we think was him. To the apartments. All right, said our radio guy finally. They want us inside. I ran from the trees to the apartment complex where a SEAL lieutenant was organizing the overwatches. He had a map of the city and showed us where the assault was going to take place the next day. We need to cover this area here, here, and here, he said. Y'all go find a room to do it. He gave us a building, and off we went. I'd been paired with the sniper I'd met during BUDS, Ray. I've used the name to protect his identity. Ray is a big-time gun nut, loves guns, and knows 'em real well. I'm not sure how good a shot he is, but he's probably forgotten more than I know about rifles. We hadn't seen each other for years, but from what I remembered from BUDS, I figured we'd get along all right. You want to feel confident the guy you're working with is someone you can rely on. After all, you are literally trusting him with your life. A ranger we called Ranger Malloy had been shepherding our rifles and some gear with us in a Hummer. He came up and gave me my 300 Win Mag. The rifle's extra distance over the Mark 11 would be handy once I found a good hide to shoot from. Running up the stairs, I sorted the situation out in my head. I knew what side of the building I wanted to be on, and roughly where I wanted to be. When I reached the top, I decided I wanted to shoot from a room rather than the roof. I started walking through the hall, scanning for an apartment that had the right view. Going inside, I looked for one with furniture I could use to set up. To me, the home I was in was just another part of the battlefield. The apartments and everything in them were just things to be used to accomplish our goal, clearing the city. Snipers need to either lie down or sit for a long period of time, so I needed to find furniture that would let me do that as comfortably as possible. You also need something to rest your rifle on. In this case, I was going to be shooting out of the windows, so I needed to be elevated. As I searched through the apartment, I found a room that had a baby crib in it. It was a rare find, and one I could put to good use. Ray and I took it and flipped it over. That gave us a base. Then we pulled the door of the room off its hinges and put it on top. Now we had a stable platform to work on. Most Iraqis don't sleep on beds. They use bed rolls, thick mats, or blankets that are put directly on the floor. We found a few of them and laid them out on the door. That made a semi-comfortable elevated bed to lie on while working the gun. A rolled mat gave us a place to rest the end of our guns on. We opened the window and were ready to shoot. We decided we'd work 3 hours on, 3 hours off, rotating back and forth. Ray took the first watch. I started rummaging through the complex to see if I could find any cool shit. Money, guns, explosives. The only thing I found worth acquisitioning was a handheld Tiger Woods golf game. Not that I was authorized to take it, or even did take it, officially. If I had taken it, I would have played it the rest of the deployment. If I'd done that, it might explain why I'm actually pretty good at the game now. If I had taken it. I got on the 300 Win Mag in late afternoon. The city I was looking out at was brownish yellow and gray, almost as if everything was shaded the light sepia of an old photograph. Many, though not all, of the buildings were made of bricks or covered with stucco in the same color. The stones and roadways were gray. A fine mist of desert dust seemed to hover over the houses. There were trees and other vegetation, but the overall landscape looked like a collection of dully painted boxes in the desert. Most of the buildings were squat houses, two stories high, occasionally three or four. Minarets or prayer towers poked out of the grayness at irregular intervals. There were mosque domes scattered around, Here a green egg flanked by a dozen smaller eggs, there a white turnip glinting white in the sinking sun. The buildings were packed in tight, the streets almost geometrical in their grid pattern. There were walls everywhere. The city had already been at war for some time, and there was plenty of rubble not only around the edges but in the main thoroughfares. Dead ahead of me, but out of view, was the infamous bridge where the insurgents had desecrated the bodies of the Blackwater contractors half a year earlier. The bridge spanned the Euphrates, which flowed in an inverted V just south of my position. My immediate concern was a set of railroad tracks about 800 yards from the building. There was a berm and a train trestle over the highway south of me. To the east, on my left, as I looked out the window, the train line ran to a switching yard and station outside the main part of the city. The marine assault would sweep across the tracks, driving down and into an area from the Euphrates to a highway at the eastern end of the city, marked by a clover leaf. This was an area roughly 3 1/3 miles wide. The plan was to move about a mile and a half deep to Iraqi Route 10 by November 10, a little less than 3 days. That might not seem like a lot. Most Marines can probably walk that far in a half hour. But the path lay through a rat's nest of booby-trapped streets and past heavily armed houses. Not only did the Marines expect to be fighting literally house to house and block to block, but they also realized that things would probably get worse as they went. You push the rats from one hole, and they congregate in the next. Sooner or later, they run out of places to run. Looking out the window, I was anxious for the battle to start. I wanted a target. I wanted to shoot someone. I didn't have to wait all that long. From the building, I had a prime view across the railroad tracks and the berm, and then beyond that, into the city. I started getting kills soon after I got on the gun. Most were back in the area near the city. Insurgents would move into that area, trying to get into position to attack or maybe spy on the Marines. They were about 800 meters away, across the railroad tracks and below the berm, so probably, in their mind, they couldn't be seen and were safe. They were badly mistaken. I've already described what it felt like to take my first sniper shot. There may have been some hesitation in the back of my mind, an almost unconscious question. Can I kill this person? But the rules of engagement were clear, and there was no doubt the man in my scope was an enemy. It wasn't just the fact that he was armed and maneuvering toward the Marines' position, though those were the important points for the ROEs. Civilians had been warned not to stay in the city, and while obviously not everyone had been able to escape, only small handfuls of innocents remained. The males of fighting age and sound minds within the city limits were almost all bad guys. They thought they were going to kick us out, just as they supposedly had kicked out the Marines in April. After the first kill, the others come easy. I don't have to psych myself up or do anything special mentally. I look through the scope, get my target in the crosshairs, and kill my enemy before he kills one of my people. I got 3 that day. Ray got 2. I would keep both eyes open while I was on the scope. With right eye looking through the scope, my left eye could still see the rest of the city. It gave me better situational awareness. With Kilo. As the Marines moved into the city, they soon reached a position where we could no longer cover them from the apartment towers. We came down ready for the next phase, working in the city itself. I was assigned to Kilo Company, helping the Marine units on the western side of the city. They were the first wave of the assault, sweeping down block by block. Another company would come in behind them, securing the area and making sure that none of the insurgents snuck back in behind them. The idea was to clear Fallujah out, block by block. The properties in this part of the city, as in many Iraqi cities, were walled off from their neighbors by thick brick and stucco walls. There were always nooks and crannies for insurgents to hide in. The backyards, usually flat with hard dirt or even cement, were rectangular mazes. It was a dry, dusty place even with the river nearby. Most of the houses didn't have running water. The water supply would be on the roof. I worked with Marine snipers for several days during the first week or so of that phase of the assault. For much of the time, I was paired with 2 Marine snipers and a JTAC. a SEAL who could call in airstrikes. There would also be a few support guys, Marines who would provide security and occasionally help out with different tasks. These were Marines who wanted to be snipers. After their deployment, they were hoping to ship out to the Marine Sniper School. Every morning would start with about 20 minutes of what we called fires, mortars, artillery, bombs, missiles, rockets. It all amounted to a hell of a lot of ordnance being dumped on key enemy positions. The fire would take out ammo caches or dumps, or soften up spots where we thought we'd have a lot of resistance. Black funnels of smoke would rise in the distance, caches hit by the bombings. The ground and air would rumble with secondary explosions. At first, we were behind the Marine advance, but it didn't take long before I realized we could do a better job by getting ahead of the squad on the ground. It gave us a better position, allowing us to surprise any insurgents who tried rallying to the ground unit. It also gave us a hell of a lot more action, so we started taking houses to use as hides. Once the bottom of the house was cleared, I'd run up the stairs from the top floor to the roof, emerging in the small shack that typically sheltered the entrance to the roof. Sure the roof was clear, I'd move over to the wall at the edge, getting my bearings, and set up a position. Usually there would be something on the roof I could use, a chair or rugs, to make things more comfortable. If not, there was always something downstairs. I'd switched back to the Mark 11, realizing that most of my shots would be relatively close because of the way the city was laid out. The weapon was more convenient than the Win Mag, and at these ranges, just as deadly. Meanwhile, the Marines on the ground would work down the street, usually side to side, clearing the houses. Once they reached a point where we could no longer cover them, we'd move up and take a new spot, and the process would start over again. Generally, we shot from roofs. They gave us the best view and were often already equipped with chairs and the like. Most in the city were ringed by low-rise walls that provided protection when the enemy shot back. Plus, using the roofs allowed us to move quickly. The assault wouldn't wait for us to take our time getting in position. If the roof was no good, we would shoot from the upper story, usually out of a window. Once in a while, we would have to blow a sniper hole in the side of a wall to set up a firing position. That was rare, though. We didn't want to draw more attention to our position by setting off an explosion, even if it was relatively small. The holes were patched after we left. One day we were set up inside a small office building that had been vacated some time before. We pulled the desks back from the windows and sat deep in the room. The natural shadows that played on the wall outside helped hide the position. The bad guys. The enemies we were fighting were savage and well-armed. In just one house, the Marines found roughly 24 guns, including machine guns and sniper rifles, along with homemade rocket stands and a mortar base. That was just one house on a long block. It was a nice house, in fact. It had air conditioning, elaborate chandeliers, and fancy Western furniture. It made a good place to rest while we took a break one afternoon. The houses were all searched carefully, but the weapons were usually pretty easy to find. The Marines would go inside and see a grenade launcher propped against a china cabinet, with rockets stacked next to the teacups below. At one house, Marines found dive tanks. Apparently, the insurgent who had been staying at the house used them to sneak across the river and make an attack. Russian equipment was also common. Most of it was very old. In one house, there were rifle grenades that could have been made during World War II. We found binoculars with old communist hammer and sickle emblems, and IEDs, including some cemented into walls, were everywhere. A lot of people who have written about the battles in Fallujah mention how fanatical the insurgents were. They were fanatical. But it wasn't just religion that was driving them. A good many were pretty doped up. Later on in the campaign, we took a hospital they'd been using at the outskirts of the city. There we found cooked spoons, drug works, and other evidence of how they prepared themselves. I'm not an expert, but it looked to me that they would cook up heroin and inject it before a battle. Other things I've heard said they would use prescription drugs and basically anything they could get to help get their courage up. You could see that sometimes when you shot them. Some could take several bullets without seeming to feel it. They were driven by more than just religion and adrenaline, even more than bloodlust. They were already halfway to paradise, in their minds at least. Under the Rubble. One day I came down from a roof to take a break and headed out into the backyard of the house with another SEAL sniper. I pulled open the bipod on my rifle and set it down. All of a sudden, there was an explosion right across from us, maybe 10 feet away. I ducked, then turned and saw the cement block wall crumbling. Just beyond it were two insurgents, AKs slung over their shoulders. They looked as stunned as we must have. They, too, had been taking a break when a stray rocket hit, or maybe some sort of IED went off. It felt like an old Western duel. Whoever got to their pistol the quickest was going to live. I grabbed mine and started shooting. My buddy did the same. We hit them, but the slugs didn't drop them. They turned the corner and ran through the house where they'd been, then cut out into the street. As soon as they cleared the house, the Marines pulling security on the road shot them down. At one point, early in the battle, an RPG hit the building I was working from. It was an afternoon when I'd set up back from a window on the top floor. The Marines on the ground had started to take fire on the street ahead. I began covering them, taking down targets one by one. The Iraqis started firing back at me, fortunately not too accurately, which was usually the way they shot. Then an RPG hit the side of the house. The wall took the brunt of the explosion, which was good news and bad news. On the plus side, it saved me from getting blasted. But the explosion also took down a good chunk of the wall. It crashed onto my legs, slamming my knees into the concrete and temporarily pinning me there. It hurt like hell. I kicked some of the rubble off and kept firing at the bastards down the block. "Everybody okay?" yelled one of the other boys I was with. I'm good," I yelled back. But my legs were screaming the opposite. They hurt like a son of a bitch. The insurgents pulled back. Then things stoked up again. That was the way it would go. A lull followed by an intense exchange, then another lull. When the firefight finally stopped, I got up and climbed out of the room. Downstairs, one of the boys pointed at my legs. "You're limping," he said. "Fucking wall came down on me." He glanced upward. There was a good-sized hole in the house where the wall had been. Until that point, no one had realized that I'd been in the room where the RPG had hit. I limped for a while after that. A long while. I eventually had to have surgery on both knees, though I kept putting it off for a couple of years. I didn't go to a doctor. You go to a doctor and you get pulled out. I knew I could get by.
Context of White Supremacy. We will pick up next Friday on 248. 248, we are closing in on the halfway point of the book. 248 for next Friday, the subheading, Fry Me Not. Fry Me Not. Anywho, folks who would like to chime in, the number 760-569-7676. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Should have about a half hour left in the broadcast. Everybody who dialed in with a hand up, your line should be open. Feel free to chime in.
Good night. I was on this Scott McKellen, whatever, I can't pronounce his last name, this white man's website. It says here that he has an interest in military history, intense patriotism, and experience with long-range hunting rifles compelled him to accurately record the battlefield experiences of Chris Kyle. So I'm really thinking now that this guy just made things up. I think all of it's just, like, made up.
Mr. McEwen, if folks check some of the other projects that he has been an author for, it's all of it, I think almost everything that I saw at least, was associated with killing, warfare, battles,
And it looks like some of it is fiction, right? Like it's advertised as a novel, so that people know that this is, you know, him just making stuff up. So it certainly seems like he definitely has a major interest and a skill set that would enable him to construct something where you can weave in some bits of things that did happen, and then, you know, anything else that you just want to add on to embellish and either aid the propaganda effort to recruit more folks to go out and be killers in the U.S. military, and or for whatever other purposes this book serves in reinforcing the system of white supremacy and promoting some of the core values in the system of white supremacy. But, you know, Scott McEwen. Other thoughts? Other thoughts? Other feedback?
Yeah, and he seemed very trigger happy. He said that at one point he just wanted to kill, like he just wanted to kill somebody. It's like it didn't come, it came right after he started to kill. It was like after he had the first kill, the second kill was much easier. He keeps saying that stuff. And he says stuff like, you know, he always wish he could kill more. Like it was never enough. There was never enough dead bodies for him. There could always be more. And then in the beginning, his wife chokes his wife in the sleep or something like that. He's just like a psychopath, like a loose cannon. Yeah, that's my observations.
Appreciate that. Any other folks on the line have things they wanted to share?
Yeah, so it's Thomas Smith again. I had a quick one, very graphic and detailed about how to get into position. I mean, actually, it's been the best part of the book so far. I felt like I was there for a second, you know, kicked out the roof and set up a chair and we got the bed and flipped over the crib. I mean, it sounded very, very, you know, like detailed. And then he says they shoot up heroin and fight. Now, I've been around a few heroin addicts in my day, and I ain't never see no one able to go and get into no war after they shot up some dope. I mean, that just didn't make any sense. And quickly, you know, I was talking to a black female employee who at my job who said that she saw the movie, and I said, oh, okay, in my, you know, book club, we're reading the book, and da-da-da-da. So she asks, you know, she starts describing parts of the movie, and I say, oh, you know, well, so far in the book, you know, and then it's, of course, a white lady, a very refined young racist. She jumps into the conversation, you know, what you guys talking about. So we both kind of, you know, kind of brush her off, and she says, oh, I heard you say you're reading a book about a sniper. Is it the D.C. sniper? Now, I'm thinking, now, after reading, I mean, I associate sniping with white people. I mean, white people seem to now associate sniping with black people. I mean, I was like, oh, I'm talking about the sniper. Who, you know, she acted like she didn't know what I was talking about. And I was like, wow, you know, but the first person you think of is the D.C. sniper. So very strange, but that's my observation so far.
Just real quick on that, I think, I'm not sure it was last week. It might have been the first week when it was released, back December 25th when it came out. A white person wrote a review, scathing review of this film and the book and all of it, with a whole lot. Like I said, it's a whole lot of white people who think that this book is a fabrication. They just made this up. And it's a whole lot of white people taking that stance. This is one of the white people who wrote this review, but he compared Chris Kyle to John Muhammad, saying that we are glorifying a killer. It would be the same thing if somebody put out a movie and saying that John Muhammad is this great guy and is wonderful and we should all try to be, he was a veteran too, we should try to be like him and he was a patriot. And a lot of white were just furious, like, how are you dare compare Chris Kyle, he is a patriot, and compare him to some filth like John Muhammad. But that was just within the last 2 weeks somebody compared the two.
Unbelievable. So they found something else to slander us with. Now when you think of sniping, you know, white people automatically, first thing that pops in their head is not the Navy or the military or any of that stuff. it's a black person. And lastly, earlier the lady added that they didn't have, she didn't think they had a lot of money. And as far as I know, the SEALs get paid way more than the rest of the military to go on some of these crazy missions where, you know, they might have to get a hostage for whatever. And I mean, as far as I've always seen, they always get, like, you know, maybe a few, I mean, a lot more than the rest of the military to go on some of these outlandish missions that we'll never know about.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, am I just thinking of another book? Didn't he say something about he didn't make any money until they got a chance to join those mercenaries, like, what was it called? Blackwater or something like that? I don't know, but I guess you could. And SEALs could get more money, especially any underwater stuff pays more per hour. But then again, those people don't last long either. So, but I like the fact that with all of, you know, him looking through the scope and watching people's brains explode when he, you know, shoots at them, being able to see all that blood and gore close up and, you know, through the scope. I like the fact that they stopped and they repaired the holes in the walls that they made when they, you know, unfortunately had to occasionally do that in the homes. And also the fact that they gave those people $300 as soon as they were sure that they hadn't participated in any fighting, especially the males who, from any fighting age males, they gave them money to get out of the area. But the ones who stayed, if they were fighting age, of course they were monsters. And I'm curious as to where are the dogs? I know there's got to be dogs somewhere. They don't go anywhere. Even on those pictures they showed when they were torturing those people in Afghanistan, they had dogs. You know, they were torturing them with dogs. Does anyone know anything about the use of dogs during this military operation? They had to be somewhere.
Guess nobody has details on the use of dogs in this campaign. Doesn't look like he's going to touch on that in the book unless I missed it. Yeah, I'm kind of searching. I'm searching through because I have the EPUB version, and it doesn't look like he goes into any detail about dogs in the text. So somebody wants to do some research on that. Can include that as we roll.
That's a great observation, and for one thing, I know white people don't go nowhere without their dogs.
Never.
Other comments folks wanted to make sure they get in? Anybody else that's on the line?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, there's Demi Four here. I'm starting to wonder if Chris Kyle was not really working for the CIA. Because if you think about it, being a sniper, then where would he get his orders? And what individuals would they be looking to take out? And so that seems to be classified information. And then for him to disseminate this information and then wait for weeks and, you know, stalking these individuals, you know, just seems to me he's working for a high branch of the Department of Defense rather than just Department of the Army, you know, as a everyday sniper. It seems to me that SEALs and other special forces would probably fall under, you know, covert activities that would be classified. So I think he's working for a high branch of service. I mute my line.
I don't know if it was the Booker-related article, but didn't they say that he got, when he came back, there was a guy in Dallas who gave him a lot of money to start his own company. And a lot of it, and then also to get him started in the mortgage fraud, as they call it, kind of like a hedge fund. With the mortgage units, I mean the fraudulent units, and I mean we're always thinking about those people as being, you know, some of the smart white people, right? Some of the sharp white people, right? Some of the manipulators, white, right? And this guy is clearly, he's not that smart. I mean, you know, he's got his own company, he's touring around, he's getting all of these book interviews, coming across like some erudite, whatever. And he's just not that smart. We see that. We read his history. I mean, he's getting all of his funds from, you know, somebody giving him tips on the housing market, hedge funds and things like that. This is not a smart guy. I'm trying to figure out where is this mythical, these mythical white people who are so brilliant. I've met the deans of universities. They're not that brilliant. They just have more time and resources. If I could sit around all day thinking of how to train SEALs and things, you know? Yeah, if you have all the time in the world, all you have to do is just sit there. If you don't have any pressures on you to produce and try to take care of your family because you have so much extra time and money, yeah, you can spend your time figuring out how to train SEALs. So I've never met these genius white people, and I meet movers and shakers a lot. But I guess I'm not meeting the right movers and shakers. I'm not really meeting the right people. At BP, I'm just not meeting the right ones. They're not that smart. These people don't even just barely get out of high school, and some of them don't graduate. And they are ruling the world. They are ruling the world. They are not genius.
Any other folks have a hand up? Make sure they want to give any comments. Anybody we hadn't heard from? Other people, hands up. Everybody who has a hand up, line should be open.
Hi, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
So I wanted to comment on what the previous gentleman caller had mentioned about the heroin, and I thought that was a really great observation because, I mean, I don't have any personal experience with heroin, but anything that I've ever heard about it, it's an opiate, and I wouldn't imagine one would be really sized to go out and kill people on heroin. So I thought that was a very good observation, and it really just kind of reminded me about the Trayvon Martin and the Mike Brown, how both Zimmerman and Darren Wilson alluded to the possible drug interaction, be it with marijuana or whatever it was, how that, you know, had turned them into demons and these individuals. And again, that's another drug that I just don't imagine someone wanting to go out and kill someone on. It's not bath salts. It's not anything like that. So I found that really interesting. And just also the whole comment that he had made in the book about going into these houses and basically just pillaging, you know, any guns or money or anything that was there, and this whole Tiger Woods game and sort of the wink that he does to the white reader that, you know, if I had taken this, like, you know, that he didn't take it, you know, that he's innocent, that he's this, you know, individual who would only do something that was upstanding. I just found that really interesting, and that's complete white psychology to me, this idea that, you know, we don't do anything wrong. So that was just something that stood out to me that I just thought is completely in line with their behavior. Anyway, I'll mute myself. Thank you.
Absolutely. I thought that was, and again, I would just contrast that with what we heard with Henrietta Lacks, where we can't even get, I mean, we're talking about a video game, right? We're talking about embezzlement or rape or child molestation. Just, okay, I took a video game while we were, I can't even get a clean, yeah, I took it. Well, if I did, and, you know, officially I'd never do so. I mean, it's just standard practice of racism, white supremacy, and the way that these white characters in these types of books. I can't even imagine how this is going to play out in the film. I am definitely going to watch and offer my my two cents or what have you on it once I make the time to watch the film. But I feel like that is a huge difference in the way that they portray and talk about white people and what they've done, particularly when you talk about criming while white, the way that it gets presented, drastically different from these savage, drugged maniacs that they're fighting against non-white people. And I thought for a moment that I was listening to Darren Wilson as opposed to Chris Kyle with the text towards the end there. Some of the other notes that I also got all of that. The consistent dehumanization of non-white people, where he says that they made rat holes so that they could get from one building to the next without having to actually come out and be visible on the street, where he talks about they were like a pack of rats, and once they moved from one spot to another, it's just consistently with their savages, their fanatics, their rats, animals, anything that makes it easier to, yes, we should kill them, they're vermin, we should kill all of them. Same type of propaganda campaign that Joseph Goebbels ran in Nazi Germany during the Third Reich. I also thought it was significant. In my view, it is very sexualized, the way that they're talking about killing, and that's something that's come on the program a lot. Dr. Curry talked about that, how practicing white supremacy and killing non-white people ends up almost being like an aphrodisiac. I'm paraphrasing, but he said that both his last visit, which was just a couple weeks ago, and his visit from this past summer, but just the phrases that he talks about, where he says he was looking forward to getting some action. We were looking forward to getting it on. He said from our first segment, he talked about lusting for his brother's gun. To me, it just seems very consistent, this sexualized way of talking about violence and killing. And that's something that I think is pretty consistent, ubiquitous throughout the entire system of racism, white supremacy, throughout white culture, the way that white people just seem to just have this insatiable appetite for killing and inflicting harm, lethal harm on other people, especially black people. This rejoicing of violence, Mr. Fuller has talked about this, how it's so the psychosis of bragging about kills. Like, I'm going to put another notch on my belt. You even see, I mean, that's the whole history of John Wayne and Patton, and it's rife throughout the system of white supremacy. But him saying, I got three that day and Ray got two, this kind of weird, keeping a tote board, even though he says at the beginning, people ask me about how many people I killed, and, you know, my response is, what does it matter? Is that going to make me more of a man or lesser of a man? And it's just obvious. It comes through almost every page. This bragging and boasting and desire to kill more, got to kill more. I wish I had killed more and I couldn't wait to kill somebody. And then to have the audacity and come back and say that the savages that they were fighting against had some sort of fanatical bloodlust. It's hypocrisy and projection. It abounds. Let's see. Also, same thing. The contradiction where he's talking about this sniper, non-white person known as Mustafa, where he says, while we were on the berm watching the city, we were also watching warily for an Iraqi sniper known as Mustafa. From the reports we heard, Mustafa was an Olympics marksman who was using his skills against Americans and Iraqi police and soldiers. Several videos had been made and posted boasting of his ability. And it's like, well, why? You all have made a whole movie and have done this for years of bombing, inflicting all sorts of terror. I mean, you can go back and watch them bombing non-white people in Vietnam. You can go back and watch them bombing non-white people in Japan during World War II. They have a whole history of going and inflicting all types of violence. You can even watch them domestically bomb the MOVE organization in Philadelphia. So they have a whole history of having snuff, not to mention all of the snuff films that we've got over the past few weeks. Tamir Rice, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Marlene Pinnock, you can just ride all the way out. But the audacity that these savages would do the same thing that we do, oh, they've got to be, we've got to kill them all. Let's see. Oh my God, yeah. This will be my last one. I'm glad I'll get this in before we get anybody else. They have comments they want to get in before we conclude. This is on page 222 where he says, many, if not all, the 200 mosques in the city became fortified bunkers since the insurgents knew that Americans respected houses of worship as sacred and therefore were reluctant to attack. I have no idea when this respect for houses of worship manifested, evolved amongst whites. Whites are notorious for bombing black churches in this area of the world, and this practice has continued. There was a report that came out this summer where a church in Tennessee, where the there was a cross burned on the church property right in front of the congregation, not in front of the people, just in front of the building. But that was just from this past July, in addition to the bombings of black churches continuing on up through the 90s, if not on into present day, in addition to the attack that happened at the Sikh temple in Wisconsin in 2012, in addition to all of the activity post 9/11, where there were all of these reports of entrapment and different investigations that were happening at mosques and trying to spy on and infiltrate these religious organizations. So I can't even call it nonsense. Just that same sort of racist deception where they try to give this false sense of morality that whites have some sort of basic standards that they will adhere to. And ballot's been a lot of that, rules of engagement, and we're doing this the correct way and we're going by due process. And that is just nonsense to even have Blackwater mentioned as a victim in this text. I think we talked about that before, how whites consistently project themselves as victims. To have Blackwater positioned as a victim of some sort of violence, that is striking, given all the reports of their alleged misdeeds and killing and violence that they inflicted on non-white people in particular. But I will stop there. If anybody has any other comments that they want to get in, see if we can wrap in like 5 minutes. Any other comments folks want to make sure they get in?
Yes. I'll wait.
Was it somebody else? Did y'all hear somebody else? I didn't hear anybody else, Carla. Go ahead.
Yeah, I always wondered why the 100-plus countries that offered to go in and do relief work and give aid to the people who suffered from, you know, after Hurricane Katrina and the levees failed. I said, my goodness, that's even more cruel than I ever thought possible for the United States, not to let them accept any aid at all from anyone. And I said, well, maybe that's why. Maybe they knew they had their military in there, and maybe they knew that they were doing inappropriate things, and they really didn't want any outside documentation from other countries. Because it seemed exceptionally harsh to me. I mean, really, really harsh. And I think maybe that's what it was. Maybe that's what they were covering up.
Can I hear?
Yes, sir.
I just always keep in mind when reading about what white people are doing and hearing what they're doing. I mean, when you read the text, the guys going, the authors going into a lot of details on weapons and the environment that he's in, and I just always go back, okay, white people are this aware of their environment and how to load weapons and how to use weapons, and how these people coming out saying that white people are ignorant about racism and all these different things, it just doesn't equate, it doesn't match up, because if these people can be so detailed, when you read the text, it's the guy, he's very detailed in what he's describing, And it's just like, okay, white people are very detailed. White people are very aware of what they're dealing with. And when they're focused on something, they're focused on it. So when people come out and say that, oh, white people are ignorant about racism, it's just ludicrous, because these people have to be aware of what they're doing in order for everything to be so organized and detailed where it's going. So that's all I had.
Well, to me so far, this book is fitting Dr. Welsing perfectly. I mean, the gun, as you said, Gus, is being sexualized. I mean, according to Dr. Wells, and one of the things that helped me get a grasp on the understanding of racism, white supremacy, was when she described the gun as their penis. And, you know, the bullets is the testicles. So, I mean, yeah, that they don't give birth, they take lives, you know. That's how they survive. That's how they've been able to be on top of the food chain at 10% of the population. You know, so it fits her to a T, what she says about that, just their pathology altogether. You know, it's that gun is the penis that's allowed them to keep generating all these years. It hasn't been anything else.
Anything else? Folks want to make sure they get in before we wrap up. I will assume everybody is content for the week. I thought his passage, 90% of being cool is looking cool, and you look so much cooler wearing a ball cap. Yeah. System of White Supremacy. Again, we'll be picking up next week. I think next week, by the time we're done, we should be halfway through the book. Hopefully we can stay on pace. We won't have any more audio snafus, and everything will be good to go, and we'll be done with this book sometime in the early part of February. At least that is the hope. If you have any questions, if you find anything, you want to do any research on other reviews of the book or the film, you have other background information that you think is relevant with regards to the conflict in Iraq down through the years, or anything else that, you know, is touched on in the book, feel free. You can email it untiljustice@gmail.com, and we'll share. And or if you're just, I know more people listen to the archives than the live program, so if you have thoughts on what you've heard and you can't participate live, you can email them in, and then we can just read your comments during the broadcast in the upcoming weeks. As I said, we should have another month before we wrap this book up. We should be back tomorrow. The compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, catching up on news, observations, the last 7 days, workplace racism. Folks emailed in some questions and things that happened on the jobs. We'll address that as well. And then we should be here on Monday as well. So stay tuned. We'll update all the upcoming broadcasts for 2015. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener supported counter racist radio. PayPal is in the top right corner. If you are not feeling PayPal, drop me an email and we will get you a mailing address. Thanks for all the folks who have invested. Thanks for all the folks who listened and called in. I hope that has been a constructive investment of your Friday evening. Remain safe. Remain codified. I would assert, given what we've read in the text thus far, if this is indicative of white people in general, it would be best to remain sober, since the E's are the folks that are in charge of the planet right now. If you are going to consume any intoxicants, I would encourage, be at your house or someone else's residence where there are no whites, where you can, you know, just stay there for the evening, leave the next day once you're sober, lucid, clear thinking, so you can make the best
possible choice to preserve your life. Again, under conditions of war, white terrorism, sobriety would be best. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Help us maximize black self-respect at all times, in all places, every area of people activity, and each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice as soon as possible. Context of White Supremacy, signing out. Thanks for tuning in.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.